order today. Great attendance. Appreciate that. We're going to be hearing a public, hearing on House Bill 5030A in Gross as it came over from the House, and looking for some good commentary to help guide us in our deliberations and see what we need to do. There's certainly been a lot of discussion. With that, we'll start off. We've got sign-up sheets, so please sign up to give testimony. We have a lot of people, it looks like, so I'd appreciate if people keep their comments to the point, fairly brief, no more than 5 minutes, hopefully a little bit less if that's possible, just so everyone can get a chance to testify. A lot of people have come some distance to talk about things that are very, very important to not only them, but to us here in the state of Oregon. So let's start off. Have you come up in groups, if that's okay, and groups of two or three. Let's have Bob Castagna, Jim Davis, and Elizabeth Byers come forward, please. Give your name and address for the record, and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schrader. For the record, Bob Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. Thank you for taking this testimony at this stage of the session on the Department of Human Services budget. What I've asked the staff to hand out to you is a three-page double-sided document. And what this document reflects is the composite of safety net issues of concern to the Oregon Catholic Conference since the beginning of the session. The third two-page sided document that I've handed you, it's the last page in this three-page document set, is entitled Maintain the Safety Net of State Programs for Vulnerable Persons. That was the advocacy information that we handed to people on February 17th when the Oregon Catholic Conference Advocacy Day was held here at the Capitol. So since the beginning of the session, the Oregon Catholic Conference has been concerned about maintaining the safety net of state programs for poor and vulnerable persons in the state of Oregon. Just to review them briefly, emergency assistance, medically needy, general assistance, survivability levels 15 through 17, survivability levels 10 through 14, the Oregon Health Plan, the line items that were scheduled to be reduced, Oregon Project Independence, in the Children's, Adult, and Families Cluster, the TANF reduction of $5 a month, the minimum copay increase in the employment-related daycare program, reducing support services through the jobs program that help people find and maintain employment, assisted living payments, reduced rates for 138 nursing facilities, residential care, adult foster care, psychiatric daycare treatment, community mental health, Medicare premiums, developmental disabilities, and other cuts. On May 2nd, the Oregon Catholic Conference, joined by Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, submitted a list of programs to the Department of Human Services, and we requested what would it cost to maintain the current service level of programs for safety net programs. And the first two pages of the three-page document that I have given to you is the department's work, program by program, saying what it would cost between the governor's revised budget less the legislative adopted budget at the end of 2001-2003. At the end of the first page, you see a total of approximately $430 million. In further conversation with the department, with Senator Frank Shields and Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and Oregon Catholic Conference in a meeting, we concluded that because this figure did not include caseload increases above the 2001-03 budget, plus administrative services, that it would take almost $600 million of additional general fund appropriations to maintain the safety net of programs from the 01-03 legislative adopted budget into the 03-05 budget. Now, I have briefly reviewed the budget report and measure summary of bill number House Bill 5030A engrossed as it came across from the House Special Committee on the Budget. What is not clear to the Oregon Catholic Conference in reviewing this document, and I have already indicated this to Mr. Britton of the fiscal staff, I've already indicated this to Ms. Joyce of the Department of Human Services, is that we request the professional help of the legislative fiscal staff and the department to determine what is in, what is out, what is increased, what is not completely funded between the requests that we made going back to February and reflected in the department's report to us and what came across in the House passed version of 5030. It is not self-revealing in this document, on a program-by-program basis, to my eyes at least, as to what has been funded and what has not been funded. So it makes it difficult to testify and to ask you to appropriate additional money for specific safety net programs when the document itself does not reveal that to me. And I need the professional assistance of your fiscal staff and the department to try to come to that bottom line. What's included? What's not included? On a program-by-program basis, as we have requested since February of this session.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Assistant Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. I appreciate very much what we're hearing from Mr. Castagna, and it would seem to me that before we can move forward in a deliberative way, it would be very helpful to have the information that he's requesting in the form that he's requesting it. How can we make that happen, and how much time would it take to develop a document like that, Mr. Britton?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, the Legislative Fiscal Office prepared a fairly detailed discussion, written text of the governor's balanced budget. We've prepared add-back lists of various sorts. In the House committee, we had spreadsheets that showed exactly what was added back, and I'd be happy to go over all of those with Mr. Castagna.
Would that, Mr. Chair, if I may continue, would that satisfy the request that you're making, Mr. Castagna, to get the information in that form?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, if we could go down with the fiscal staff, whom we respect very much and have the greatest regard for, program by program, to determine what would be needed to restore the safety net to where we were 0103, we would be very much appreciative of that. I just want to conclude by reminding the committee of a line in the scriptures as we talk about safety net issues. And the effective line from the scriptures is, what you have done for the least of these, you have done for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Jim, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Jim Davis, representing United Seniors of Oregon, the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, Save Oregon Seniors, the Alzheimer's Association of Oregon, and Mental Health Matters Coalition. I've submitted to you three statements, one from the Advocacy Coalition, one from Mental Health Matters, and one from Save Oregon Seniors and United Seniors of Oregon. So I will simply summarize my thoughts to you in a short period of time. Here. As a gerontologist and advocate over the last 30 years, I've been able to participate in and watch the senior and disability service system grow into a national model of community-based care and effectiveness that has allowed seniors and people with disabilities to remain in their own communities and live independent lives. Then over the last 2 years, I've watched and we've watched in our advocacy circles as these very critical services have systematically been torn down. What we have submitted to you today is our very strong, urgent hope that you will protect and maintain senior and disability services in the state of Oregon. We're asking right now for five areas in particular. We'd like to see the restoration of Oregon Project Independence, the $11.7 million indicated in the House bill, allowing this cornerstone community-based long-term long-term care program to reach thousands more clients each month than would be reached if we went with the bare bones budget that has been recommended in many circles. We ask for a restoration of all funding cuts to assisted living to keep this option open for Medicaid eligible clients. We ask for the restoration of the Medicaid community-based care services through survivability levels 14 at a minimum to at least return these services to thousands who are now being threatened at being cut, their services being cut. We ask for the restoration of the medically needy program, which provides critical prescription drugs and other services to low-income seniors and people with disabilities, and a program near and dear to my heart. We ask for the restoration of the retired and senior volunteer programs that are funded not only to reach seniors and people with disabilities through the fine work of these senior volunteers, but also to reach disadvantaged youth who they are impacting through the school systems statewide. We feel very strongly that if these needs are not met, ultimately you will be paying a much higher price as these individuals come back through the system at much higher levels, costing the state a lot more. You really aren't going to save a lot of money by cutting these individuals out of service. The people that we have dealt with at survivability, even down levels down to 17, are actually quite frail individuals with very serious health problems. And ultimately, we will see these people again if we don't take a more preventative approach to caring for their needs. We have also been very active in advocating with other major mental health advocacy groups statewide through the Mental Health Matters Coalition for an adequate mental health budget. As a psychologist, a social psychologist myself, I've worked for many years in this system and am very saddened by what I'm seeing in terms of cuts to those with mental illness and chemical dependency problems. As it is, the system is not adequate. I can talk to you and hopefully will next session about the critical need to reach underserved populations like seniors and people of color. But today we come and join hands with mental health organizations and ask that you restore coverage for mental health services for people of all ages, to restore the Oregon Health Plan, mental health and chemical dependency services and health care services, the medically needy coverage for mentally ill, general assistance, money, $8 million for alcohol and drug treatment, money for day treatment for children and adolescents, money for supported employment to assist in recovery, money for essential housing for the seriously mentally ill, and money for evidence-based, cost-effective treatment approaches in the community. It is very, very important as a family member who has a sister with bipolar disorder and a sister-in-law with bipolar disorder, I can tell you the critical need for these kind of services, and without them, I know what would happen to my loved ones, and I know that other family members in the audience share that perspective as well. The budget that came over from the House, in some ways, it has some very good additions that we appreciated. OPI is a good example, of course, RSVP and others, but it is not an adequate DHS budget. Thousands and thousands of people will be put out of services, and the need in the state will grow so great that ultimately you're going to have to respond to a growing group of individuals who become sicker and sicker, and you're going to have to pay significant amounts of dollars in the future to care for their needs at much higher levels. We ask you to respond to this need now and increase the DHS budget to take care of the needs of seniors and people with disabilities and those with mental health and chemical dependency problems. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Davis. Good testimony. Yes, ma'am, go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Schrader and members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Byers. I live at 185 Eola Drive Northwest. I'm in Polk County. And I'm a woman with a disability. I'm the sole provider with income in my family. My husband's disabled, and he's not able to work at this time. I have two children who are working and in college, and a mother who's also disabled and living in supported housing in Newport. Everything rests on my shoulders, and I can tell you in my family, we are one paycheck away from all of us being on Social Security, one paycheck away from all of us depending on these social services that you're talking about, trading out and saving money. I just can tell you in my life, I have friends who right now have lost services. I do what I can. All of us in our circle do what we can to augment and supplement services that have been lost for our friends. So we're all of us carrying an extra burden that we didn't have a year ago and that we couldn't have even have considered 2 years ago. We never would have thought that we would have lost all the services that supported our community. So I'm just asking you because at any time we could, my whole family could be asking you for services, and I'm just asking that you consider raising the revenues that that those of us who are still working are putting into the system to use those resources together and in a pool that's going to support more people than just the folks that I know in my community. It's really important. We're really depending on you, and we're already paying extra, and we'd like our money to go into a larger pool with everybody's extra intent to support these services. And I want to thank everybody here for being here and considering these issues. And this is the, you know, this is the end of the line for so many people. Please be considering that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Appreciate it. Let's see, can we get Bruce Bishop, Lucia? I'm sorry, I'm proud. From Willamette Valley Senior Services, CLP, excuse me, Karen, and Karen Whitaker and Craig Hostetler come forward.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing this morning on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems and offering our perspectives on the House version of House Bill 5030, the appropriation for the Department of Human Services, including the Oregon Health Plan. My comments will focus on the Oregon Health Plan and the budget challenges that you face this session in putting together a budget to meet the needs of Oregon Health Plan enrollees, providers, and their communities. I think it's important for context to remember that when the House passed its version of House Bill 5030, it did so acknowledging that it was an incomplete plan, but a plan that it wished to get started through this legislative process. And unfortunately, today, it is still an incomplete plan. When the Oregon Health Plan was launched almost 10 years ago, it was set up as a demonstration project to expand coverage to low-income Oregonians through the Medicaid program. It is now being severely tested as to its capability to continue services to the population. As has always been the case, you have three basic options available to you in making this budget balance. You can control the number of people who are enrolled in the health plan. You can control the services they receive. And you can control how much is paid for providers. Each of those actions will have consequences, both good and bad, depending on the decisions that you make. The House budget before you exercised all of those options in one way or another. The House budget anticipated an enrollment of about 71,000 people in the Oregon Health Plan standard. That number is substantially below what was budgeted during the last biennium for that population. But it's important to recognize that it is also substantially above the number of people currently enrolled in OHP standard. So the challenge for you is to determine what level of enrollment is appropriate to budget for the next 2 years. We don't have 110,000 people today who are enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan standard. We probably have somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 55,000. Half of the people who previously had been in that plan have dropped coverage. And what we don't know today is what the future will hold in terms of enrollments. But the House budget proposed to budget as if there were 71,000. Again, that's substantially more than appear to be in the current program. Part of the difficulty with making those budget estimates is that we are just starting to see the effects of both benefit and cost-sharing changes that were authorized last session and implemented earlier this year. As those changes take effect, they're affecting the population, but we're in the middle of that, and we can't look back yet and really understand what the coverage will be. Second, the House budget does reduce provider payments, particularly for hospitals. It eliminates a substantial adjustment that has been recommended by the state's actuary to address underpayment issues that have occurred historically in the Oregon Health Plan. And thirdly, and probably most importantly from our perspective, the House budget eliminates an entire category of services. Those are hospital services. That includes inpatient, outpatient, and emergency care services. Under the House budget, all those services would be eliminated for the Oregon Health Plan standard population. But I think it's fair, again, to mention that that is not necessarily the House plan, and we are working to restore those benefits through additional resources that could be made available. There are strong reasons why it's important for this assembly to support the Oregon Health Plan. For every dollar that you invest in the Oregon Health Plan and in the Medicaid program, the state attracts $1.50. And that $2.50 in services then ripples throughout local economies in hospital payrolls as well as in care to patients. Conversely, every dollar you cut will result in a reduction of $2.50 in services. So when you cut a state dollar in the Medicaid program, you're losing $2.50 in services, not just a dollar. If you cut that state dollar, we lose the federal match that would be available to support health services throughout the state. At the end of my testimony, I've produced an example of the proportionate share of hospital reductions that would result if $100 million in total funds were eliminated from the budget. And this is just a sample of the hospitals across the state, both large and small hospitals, and the magnitude of the reductions that they would see. They're very substantial. And we think that the consequences of reducing hospital coverage to this level should not be included in the budget that you put forward. I would be glad to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sam, go right ahead.
Senator Schrader, my name is Lucille Pugh, and I represent the Mid-Willamette Valley Senior Service Agency. I am a member of the Advisory Council, and we have spent many hours in recent months talking about the dilemma facing seniors and people with disabilities. The focus of today's discussion is with seniors and people with disabilities, and our recommendation that the long-term care services, which were cut in 2001-03, be restored, that the medically needy program be restored, and that OPI funding for those in need of in-home services but who are not eligible for Medicaid. These people are part of that population who are vulnerable as health conditions change, as their ability to cope with health and other problems, including oftentimes inadequate income. And it's a part of this safety net, which I think others have referred to. We hope that these levels will be financed, and that we will continue with pride in Oregon's long-term care system, that we do have a system which promotes independence and dignity of seniors and people with disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, Ms. Whitaker, and then maybe have Mr. Rich, would you mind if Mr. Hostetler came back?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm here this morning to represent the Safety Net Clinic Coalition, and Craig Hostetler is with me. I'm wondering if I could defer to him and have him precede me in testimony.
Chair Schrader, she just deferred to me, and then Chair Schrader and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify supporting funding for the Safety Net Health Clinics. For the record, my name is Craig Hostetler, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Primary Care Association to represent clinics in support of House Bill 2970. The Safety Net Health Clinics serve primarily Oregon Health Plan patients, the uninsured and underinsured Oregonians. These clinics are frequently the only place low-income people can go for primary and preventive health care. Other providers are less and less willing to see uninsured and Medicaid patients, especially in these difficult economic times. The Oregon Primary Care Association includes the 17 federally qualified health center organizations all across Oregon. In 2002, these health centers provided primary and preventive care to more than 160,000 low-income and uninsured people by providing over 650,000 visits, or almost 650,000 visits. They've employed nearly 1,800 staff and generate over $120 million in economic output. These FQHCs are outstanding federal financial participation vehicles. They draw down match and provide cost-effective care, saving Oregon more than $10 million annually in state Medicaid expenditures alone. They save the Medicaid program more than 30% in annual spending per beneficiary due to reduced specialty care referrals, lower pharmaceutical costs, and fewer hospital admissions. Because of the economic downturn, our clinics are struggling to keep their doors open. Giving from individuals and private foundations is down, and I'm sure you've heard of this. The number of patients covered by the Oregon Health Plan is shrinking, and the number of uninsured coming through our doors is rising. Our clinics are at capacity now, so we're looking for a way that we can continue support to the people that we serve. Because of the lack of needed financial support, one clinic already is closed, and others are cutting medical and administrative staff, thus decreasing their ability to provide care for the uninsured and underserved Oregonians. But they have to do this to keep their doors open. If more clinics close, the low-income and uninsured people will have nowhere to turn to care except for hospital emergency rooms when problems have become much more critical and where care is much more expensive to everybody. If $20 million from you will help prevent the closure of more clinics, and this $20 million equates to $20 per uninsured Oregonian. We consider this a partnership. We ask our low-income patients to pay $20 on average on a sliding fee scale, and we ask our communities to contribute as also. But it still doesn't make our budgets whole. We're still seeing the shortfall, which means the cutbacks that we're experiencing. We need you to join the partnership and to help keep our safety net clinics open so they can continue seeing these uninsured and Oregon Health Plan patients. My organization represents both rural and urban clinics. As for and Karen Whitaker will speak more to rural areas, which is why I'm going first. As for urban areas, there's a growing number of uninsured, and pockets of these urban areas are very poor, and typically the only source of care for primary and preventive health care are these safety net health clinics. That's why our clinics in urban and rural areas got together and agreed on a distribution plan, if this is funded, that favors rural clinics but also provides support for urban areas. I urge you to support the healthcare safety net by allocating money through House Bill 2970. And I also didn't want this opportunity to go by without offering my support to the State Office of Health Systems Planning. This office provides vital information and support for our clinics. Thank you for your support.
Appreciate your testimony. Just for the record, we're not hearing 2970. We're actually hearing House Bill 5030. But as that relates significantly to our public health system, I think it's appropriate testimony. Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Senator Schrader, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of the State Office of Rural Health, and I'm also here today as a member of the steering committee of the Safety Net Coalition. We have been meeting for about 2 years, the Safety Net Coalition. We formed in response to an appropriation that the previous legislature made, which unfortunately has never been released, but we did agree upon a distribution plan at some point, which we have all supported. And I also want to stress that the existence of this Safety Net Clinic Coalition recognizes that all of the safety net clinics, and that includes federally qualified health centers, rural health clinics, school-based health clinics, and other private nonprofit providers of services to low-income and vulnerable populations, are a very important part of the overall healthcare system. And as the economy worsens and more people become uninsured and more people lose Oregon Health Plan and Medicaid coverage, it's the safety net clinics that pick up the slack and take care of those patients. There are really two issues with safety net clinics. One of them is access to health care, and that's access for vulnerable and low-income and uninsured populations. And that gap is filled by the safety net clinics primarily in urban and more populated areas. The second issue with safety net clinics is availability of care, and that's primarily the issue for rural health clinics. In many parts of the state, the only provider of health care is a rural health clinic, a certified rural health clinic, and that is true, for example, in Jordan Valley, in Fossil, in Christmas Valley, in Powers, and in many parts of the state where there is one small clinic serving a rather small population. And if they depended on all of that population and their patient revenues in order to keep their doors open, they still wouldn't have enough money to meet their overhead because they're in a very isolated area. So those folks depend upon outside sources of funding in order to keep their doors open and non-operating revenues. Over the years, the funds that have come to these small clinics from the legislature have kept their doors open. Last session, they weren't able to receive any of these funds, and they're very hopeful that this session some appropriation will come their way in order to help keep them operating. I'd be very happy to answer any questions that you have, and thank you very much for having this hearing today to talk about the safety net.
Very good. Thank you for coming.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I do have a question. Thank you for your testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Just to clarify, you said there was a previous appropriation made by the legislature that was never received. Could you say more about that? What was the appropriation? Where would it have gone?
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that was That would be helpful.
I'd be happy to. Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, the previous legislative session made an appropriation of $2.2 million that was made to the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, Department of Human Services, and was to be distributed through the Department of Administrative Services, but the funds were never released. And at during one of the special sessions, the funds were cut to $1.1 million, but they were still they just never did release them because they were worried about budget deficits. So we did come up with a distribution plan, but we never got to distribute.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Oh, yes. Staff.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, I want to clarify that. When the Assembly makes an appropriation of general fund, it is the full expectation that the money is released. All of those funds were cut over the course of the 2001-03 biennium. So that's why the money wasn't there to be released. Just wanted to make that clear.
Thank you.
Let's get Mr. Hazelwood, Ms. Seaton, and Ms. Rand to please come forward.
Phyllis Rand, Chairman Schrader, and members of the committee. I'm CAP coordinator for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. And the commission really appreciates all the hard work that you've been doing over the last 8 months. And we know that the choices that you have to make coming up are going to be very, very difficult ones. Though my testimony will highlight problems facing Oregon seniors and people with disabilities, the Commission urges you to fully fund critical human services for all populations. We need an Oregon health plan that meets the needs of all low-income people in our state. We need jobs programs that help low-income families get back on their feet. We need mental health and addiction programs that help those who suffer from their diseases. We need a whole system so that we can treat a whole person. Most importantly for the Commission, we need to restore, and we need to restore the Medicaid long-term care clients from priority levels 17 down to 12. Now, I know that my testimony says 12. Level 12 and level through 14. But if we need to do negotiating, then to begin where you really want to be, you've got to add in those additional levels so that you'll have something to maneuver with. And what I'd like you to do is a little thinking about people who are the clients, and just a mental picture, a mind's eye of what they look like. And clients in these levels have severe physical and financial needs, and they are not able to care for themselves adequately. And so that's why we need to support them. Restore the Medically Needy program. The impact of eliminating this program will be felt a long way down the line. Seniors and people with disabilities throughout the state are dying because they cannot access critical medications. And I think you've all seen pictures of the gentleman from Portland that lost his medication, put him in the hospital, and at great cost, and then he eventually died. Restore the General Assistance Program. Well, they were all eliminated. And this is one of the most egregious cuts that we've had. The people that are on general assistance are unable to work. They do not have income nor family support. And many even are homeless. And I just think that's the most egregious of all. Restore full funding to Oregon Project Independence. Oregon's hallmark program to treat seniors with respect and dignity by allowing them to remain in their own homes. But they still need assistance, and this program needs to be fully funded. Altogether, to restore these life-saving services would cost the state, this is a shock, a little more than $80 million. We know this sounds like a terrific amount of money, and it is. But the cost, if we don't provide these funds, is appalling. The cost in human suffering, the cost to their quality of life, the cost of people dying for no good reason, those are too great a cost. We urge you to find funding to meet these needs. Oregon seniors and people with disabilities deserve no less. Our low-income families, our children, and our ill need your help. Please don't do the head thing. Let this message pull your heartstrings, and then move and act with your heart. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ellis.
And I do have some additional data that talks about descriptions of the fourth quarter, and it lists the different counties, and I'll just leave those at the desk.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Ms. Seaton, would you like to go ahead?
Okay. My name is Carol Seaton, and I represent Save Our Services Alliance. I haven't been real involved with them, but I'm the person that's sitting on the front steps, and I haven't eaten for a while. We have the headstones out there for the people who have died as a result of budget cuts. Now, I'm going to go from there to saying that the decisions you make today are going to affect many generations, because what happens here is going to affect our survival of the fittest mentality. What does that mean? Does that mean the person who can be the most greedy and get the most out of life? Or does it mean fittest are human quality to take care of each other? My children have led the national youth crisis. My grown children are in trouble. And they came of age in the middle of the last recession. So my concern is really about the economy. Gross national product is not a measure of products, but a measure of how many times a dollar changes hands. A budget cut that will reduce employment mostly to women will be far more devastating to women and children than you can understand. I know, because I used to be a nice middle-class person doing my good thing for those people. In the last recession, I became one of those people. I returned to college like a black person, horrified by the middle-class mentality that to me became learned ignorance. During the recession, I watched the number of empty houses increase and businesses close. I experienced the increased competition for assistance. And no, we reduced the number of those served by increasing the requirements for services. My daughter's generation, I read that one. My children turned against my values as we were struggling to survive without the help we needed. It took many years for them to finally come back to middle-class values. And I don't want to see this devastation happen to another generation. Poverty, which I once thought was a meaningful experience, I found out only destroys. It destroys us physically, mentally, and emotionally. And spiritually. It destroys families and it destroys our young. Poverty destroys a whole generation of young who come to age without opportunities and without hope. I am speaking of a recession-type poverty that hits everyone. Not personal cases of unfortunate people, but when businesses close, unemployment is high, and everywhere spirits are low. People don't eat money. They use it for food and rent, and this is what keeps the money circulating. I thought policymakers last time didn't fully understand that we need to keep the money circulating. So it's also, it's such a holistic thing. It's a matter of keeping that money circulating by keeping women, mostly women, employed in the social services. And it involves how we perceive life and how our young perceive life. Are we going to teach our children that it's okay to let somebody die? Is it okay to leave someone alone in their home without help when they can't get out of bed and make themselves a meal? Is that what we want to teach our children? What are we going to teach them? And how are we going to keep that money flowing so that we have the best employment possible, the best economy possible? Please figure out how to keep that money flowing. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Mr. Hazelwood.
Good morning, Chair Schrader and members of the committee. My name is Lee Hazelwood, a longtime senior disabled advocate. I'm currently a member of Mid-Willamette Valley Senior Service Agency Advisory Council, a former member of the Governor's Commission under the last three governors. Over the years, I've represented Oregon at both the local and national level. I was a member of our state delegation to the 1995 White House Conference on Aging. And in 1996, I was elected to a four-year term to the National Silver Congress in Washington, D.C. In those capacities, I've come together with hundreds of advocates around the country. Without these exceptions, these people wanted to know about the Oregon model, commonly known as the Oregon Miracle of Long-Term Care. Other states have come to Oregon to find out how we did it. In some cases, they have hired our people away to help their states implement similar programs. This program over the years has saved the state over $500 million, and I think it's probably closer to $1 billion now. In both the governor's proposed budget and the co-chair's budget, these proposed cuts would hurt real people who are in desperate need and deserve our help. These are not just cuts. This is major surgery. The type of surgery could lead to patients' death, and you've heard testimony regarding that. All of you have heard from your constituents our great system of long-term care is the best thing to come to Oregon since electricity. In fact, it's a lawmaker's dream. What other program can give frail seniors and people with disabilities what they most value? Independence, dignity, and the delivery of necessary assistance in their own home. Fostered the creation of hundreds and hundreds of small businesses providing jobs around the state. while at the same time providing necessary services in the most cost-effective way. In 1973, Governor Bob Schraub said, and I quote him, "It is my opinion of this service to place a man or woman in an institution when, with a little help, that person can remain in his or own home and community. For many, the lifelong dream of dignity, comfort, independence, and retirement has become a nightmare of dread. Instead, there is a cruel tarnish on their golden years." Our present Speaker of the House, Karen Minnis, in her opening address to the House of Representatives, spoke of building a budget, among other things, would provide a safety net for vulnerable and less fortunate Oregonians. Oregon Project Independence clients are definitely in this category. And, Mr. Chair, you were quoted in the Monday, April 7, 2003 Oregonian as saying the co-chair's budget would emphasize programs for children and seniors. I highly agree with your comments regarding that. It's hard for me to believe that the 72nd Oregon Legislature and the governor would want to have their epitaph read, "We are the ones that helped dismantle the Oregon long-term care system." In our house, there are many books, some old and some new. Some are read once and some many times over. One of these books read many times over was written over 2,000 years ago. In that book, it said, "Do not cast me away when I am old. Do not forsake me when my strength is gone. But as for me, I will always have hope, even when I am old and gray." Mr. Chair, you and your committee have some tough choices to make. As I speak for many older Oregonians, I ask you, even though we are old and some of us bald-headed, do not forsake us. And in closing, I would like personally to thank Senator Gordley and her staff for helping me, I think, save somebody who was about 57 years old with elderly parents needing mental health. And due to Sean and Senator Gordley, I was able to get him some help. And so I thank you very much and available for questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very good testimony.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. And thank you, all of you, for your eloquent testimony. Mr. Hazelwood, you have been working on a measure that would call for a human impact statement.
Yes, ma'am.
To go along with our human services budgets. I wonder if you would take the opportunity briefly to tell the committee why it is important to have a human impact statement together with the human services budget.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, I've been working on that statement since approximately 1995. And behind that, Bill, is what's happening to people being cut out of service. We really have no way of tracking them. I know our agency has been tracking some of them. The caseworkers have been trying to do that on their own and finding out where these people are and what happened. They don't all die. Some of them do. But trying to find out and trying to get help for them, some other organizations, but a lot of those organizations are, their money is all tapped out already. So I think we need to know what happens to these people. And I appreciate your support on that and all the committee. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. For the audience's benefit, we do have another subcommittee meeting right now, so members do have to leave. It's not because you're certainly not interested here, but we have a lot of things going on at the end of session. Let's get Martin Taylor and Jacqueline Zimmer, please come forward.
Okay.
Hi, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jacqueline Zimmer-Jones. I'm the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, and I also serve as the director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And Martin is my co-chair at HISCO, along with our 50-plus member organizations that support human services programs throughout Oregon. And what we wanted to do, first of all, today was really a sincere thank you to you for your time and your energy and your attention to not only us that are here in the building every day, but to the advocates that make it down here on short notice to speak before you, and the phone calls that you take from people who can't make it. We really wouldn't want to be you right now, and I guess you probably wouldn't really want to be us either, but it's challenging for everyone, so thank you very much. HISCO, the basic principle of HISCO, if you boil it down, because we do want to be quick this morning, is that, you know, we should rise all boats together, and we are not, we're a group that's made a commitment to not pit ourselves against each other, against education, public services, public safety, any other function of state government. We recognize the importance of all of it. And what we wanted to call your attention to today was the fact that with the help of the department, we were using a list to compile this list in front of you today. We've been going through the various cuts that have occurred in human services programs in the last year, and that list was 56 pages long of just cuts to here and there and across the board, and some more cuts and this program and that program. And in essence, what we did was we went through those 56 pages, and we went through the programs that were partially restored under when ballot measure 28 failed, and some of the things that you as co-chairs have put together, and we came up with sort of what's left. And we have a survey on the front, and this is what we used in the House when they were voting on their budget. We really just wanted them to know that if they were voting yes on the budget in the House, that these are some of the things that they were voting for. And and then the rest of this list, the remainder of this document, is programs that were not included in 5030. So today you want us to speak to 5030, and we're also including in there information for you about what was not in 5030 that we felt were critical programs and things that should be added back. And if we do our math right, I think there's about $125 to $130 million worth of human services programs that we think are still outstanding, and that's just general fund only. Again, but this list really represents the best that we could do as HISCO, and I know that you know this as well, but many of the people that actually use the programs that the state provides can't get down here on their own to tell you about why those programs are important, and we have probably left some things off. But again, if most of our advocates were the kind of people that could come down here and sort of march on the Capitol, they probably wouldn't be using our services in the first place. So if you get the chance to look through this, I think that would be terrific. We also wanted to call your attention to what we think is, you know, the economic development or the economic stability component of human services, and one that is keeping families working, keeping families healthy, keeping families together, but also the amount of people that it takes to actually provide the direct services or the contract services or to provide the products that you buy as a result of human services programs. And we think that that is a significant function of the economic health of this state, and it's something that we want you to consider and not overlook when you're talking about, you know, perhaps the joys of opening up a business in Oregon that will bring 4,000 service-level jobs into the state over the next 5 or 6 years. And while we applaud that, we're also saddened by the loss of perhaps the 4,000 client-employed providers who are no longer providing direct care to seniors and people with disabilities. So keep our programs in mind when you're talking about stabilizing the economy in Oregon. One of the other things that I wanted to do just quickly is just step aside as co-chair for a moment while I have this opportunity, and I'll just talk about two functions of the seniors and people with disabilities budget. I know others will touch on it, but we saw that in 5030 the House put in significant funding for Oregon Project Independence, and boy, we couldn't be happier. However, there was no funding for clients in levels 12, 13, and 14, and 15, 16, and 17 for that matter. And I just want to mention to you that those 5,600 some odd clients in those levels of care, those are Medicaid clients. Those are clients that are actually available for services with a federal match, and they're looking for an alternative because they no longer have services. They're looking to get on to Oregon Project Independence. And so I think you're in an odd spot here. You're at a spot where OPI looks like it came over a little highly funded, but keep in mind that there are, again, those 5,000 to 6,000 people that are looking for services. And again, I think this is a really critical point. Folks in levels 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, some of those people are people with disabilities, and Oregon Project Independence is a program for seniors. I want you to know that we did try to change that a couple sessions ago, but nobody was really interested in it at the time. But that's a program for just for seniors. So the people with disabilities in 12 through 17 cannot apply for Oregon Project Independence. So they are without option completely. So we're going to ask you to take that extra step and look at refunding 12, 13, and 14 as best you can, and to keep the Oregon Project Independence funding as high as you can, and keep those folks' needs in mind. Also, if there are going to be reductions in tax credits, there might be an opportunity to create that link between, for example, the reduction to the senior medical tax deduction, and it's somewhere between, I hear the numbers, $36 to $42 million a year. It would be terrific to link that to programs for seniors and people with disabilities, and to capture the federal match. That would just about take care of all of the needs in the seniors and people with disabilities program that have been eliminated. So, you know, we're in the building anytime. If you have questions about what's on this list, again, thank you very, very much for just holding this hearing today and hearing us again, and your accessibility any day of the week. We really appreciate that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your handout in particular. It does give some very specific recommendations, points out the lack of attention to children's health care needs with school-based health clinics, perinatal programs, emergency medical. Points out that DHS talks about the Oregon health plan population being in the 94,000 population range, and the 50-30 budget from the House only funds up to maybe 68,000 clients, which is unfortunate. And the mental health area seems woefully inadequate too. From
very
looking at your list, residential beds, alcohol, drug treatment, support employment for mental health. And then, frankly, trying to get people out of this recession, looks like employment-related daycare is woefully underfunded. There's no assistance. You know, the temporary assistance need families is pretty
right.
And like you said, the 12 to 14 not even being funded, at the very least, that's an unusual situation given the fact we could pull down some matching funds and really help these people. So appreciate your hard work on it.
You're very welcome. Thank you for looking at it.
Martin, sorry.
It's all right. You're doing a great job testifying on our behalf. I wasn't going to stop you. For the record, Chair, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here as the co-chair of HISCO. I also represent the Oregon Nurses Association, a group called the Community Providers Association of Oregon, which provides residential care for disabled and mentally ill people, and the Oregon Law Center, which represents the legal aid system. I will try to be brief because we have a great group of folks to follow that are going to talk specifically about some of those programs you just mentioned, and they're all going to be brief, which is important because we have in the past done great dog and pony shows and filled the room. We felt like you probably didn't need that one more time, but it would be helpful to really go through what some of these programs at stake are. I wanted to start with just a quick overview. This really isn't just a moment in time. It's not just one decision you're making about 5030. This is the culmination of 2 years of energy around human services. For us, that's energy that's been given to 5 regular special sessions where cuts were made, and we had huge hearings, and you heard the consequences of some pretty dramatic cuts. And then it was 28, ballot measure 28, where, you know, we felt for human services that that was a lifeline. And for the first time, you really saw people with pretty serious health conditions going door to door and getting on the phones and calling their neighbors. You saw disabled people having meetings in their facilities and talking about the consequences of these cuts. This was, for the human services community, the biggest campaign probably that they've had, because they knew what would happen if it failed, and then it failed. And we had Special Session 6, and we remember that. And it was really bad. It was painful. You've had your halls filled with people who are literally here begging for their lives. And begging for their lives. That's what we came to as a state. And you had staff people in this building who became social workers. They were getting calls from constituents who weren't asking for you to pass a bill. They were asking for you to save their lives. And that's not overdramatic. Now, you know, we got a care package, and we saved some folks in the transplant program, some HIV population, some of our seniors. You know, we did something. And we should feel proud of the fact that there were members of this legislative body willing to rise to that challenge, because for a while it wasn't clear that that would happen. But the fact was that we left after 28 an enormous amount of cuts on the board. And those cuts that are left are really what's described in this document that you've got in front of you. This House Bill 5030 actually does restore some things that have been cut for months. And again, the House deserves some credit for that. But what it left out was a lot. And this becomes the part of the story where we have to go back to that a lot and figure out if we can do better, and we should. Our process of coming up with this list, Jacqueline did a good job describing. The next step in this process is yours. We want to narrow this list down to something that represents the values of Oregon and make sure that at least those things that are still lethal or untenable cuts are resolved, and also put the context in. Oregon is hurting. We are in an incredible recession. You have a high unemployment rate. You have people falling through the safety net at the same time as people who have been employed their entire lives are falling into it for the first time. That's happening simultaneously. This is the time to treat human services with more care, not less. So with that context, this document hopefully will get a lot smaller when the Senate does its work. And my understanding is that the very admirable work of Senator Carter and Winters is going to help us get there. But we're really here to talk about the budget as it passed the House. I forecast a better day ahead, though. Thank you for your hard work. So what comes next after me is a panel of folks who will go through some of these to give you some better explanations about what the specific programs do. We have 21 items on our list. I am responsible for describing one of those 21 items. It's the last one, and it's really considered the reasonable provider reimbursement rates, or COLAs. My understanding is that this is yet to be one of those items that anyone's looking to restore. But it's important that we at least understand what we're doing here. These are your privatized social services. They were Fairview and Damish, public employee, state-run facilities, and we closed them. And it was based on some values that said that we would rather have people in their communities where they can ride the local bus if they're disabled, go to the local grocery store, live in a smaller family setting, that we weren't going to warehouse people with mental illnesses or disabilities. But the consequence of that decision is that we now have a privatized system where the infrastructure are houses run by not-for-profit companies. And when you don't give them a COLA for 3 years in a row, which this budget will do, you break their backs. These aren't unionized workers. They're not making a unionized salary. These are folks who are making a salary of $10 an hour or less. Some of them get health care. Many of them don't. When you don't give them a COLA, they get pay cuts to their employees who are making $10 an hour, or they lose their health benefits. This is a population of folks with energy costs going through the roof, with insurance costs going through the roof, with facilities that need constant upgrading for their clients, and clients that are getting older and have more and more physical needs as they get older. These disabled and mentally ill folks are like all of us. They need more care as they get older. And for 3 years, we're flat funding them. Some of these facilities, some of these not-for-profit companies, will go out of business in the next 2 years. Many of them will not accept new clients because they cannot afford, when they're getting reimbursed by the state less than the cost of providing the care, they cannot afford to do this. So this is an infrastructure problem for the state. 2 years from now, you're going to have been in the spot for some time where you will have a hard time placing disabled and mentally ill people who need care because no one's there to take them and the facilities they were in are closed. That's an unattended to consequence. And to be honest, it probably, if this was a contract the state had to bargain, wouldn't be coming down this way. These are the folks that are easiest to put a freeze on because they're privatized services and they're just one step removed. Some of these folks may have been better off now if there had been a Fairview or a Damage, because at least they would have a place to be 2 years from now. Well, right now, there are some folks who may not be placeable in 2 years. So that concludes my testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Harper asked first, and then Senator Winters.
Martin, Jackie, this is really, is there a total someplace that I missed? What's all this add up to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, we totaled it at $126 million.
Roughly.
Yes, and I'm sorry, that's without the health plan. Right. That's without the health plan, yeah, thank you.
Senator,
I apologize. We were to have totaled that up for you, and I don't know exactly how I dropped the ball on that.
Senator Winters.
Just to follow up on a comment that Martin Taylor made and putting in perspective the number of special sessions that we've had and through those special sessions there were the reductions that have taken place to the human services budget. But I thank you for bringing that up because that is a piece that has happened, and so often I think that is missed somewhere in the context of when we talk about budget, as though this agency and those services have not had rollbacks from the time we started coming back into this building, and as the chair who had to be responsible for some of that, I think that those without said that we started in the 2001-03 budget and we were able to make some gains, and then we did all the gains that we had made. But I also want to follow up with something that you talked about, the COLA and the insurance issue, and whether there are several of the facilities now that are not able to get insurance coverage because of the crisis that's facing this industry, and if you know what the current status of that is.
It's not really what we're here to testify on, but I should mention that you have a bill that would help this a lot, Senate Bill 743, which hasn't moved out of Ways and Means, and it basically would allow for the part of the insurance that is liability for activities that happen on a facility. Those are the ones that they can't get insurance for at all. Insurance companies are no longer willing to take the liability risk for mentally ill people who are living together. And oftentimes disabled people who are living together, if they're cross-gender, because some disabled people with decreased judgment do things in a gender way that we would not want to do in our homes, but that makes it more difficult to insure them. This is a bill that would allow them to buy into this state's insurance pool, liability insurance pool, and it would be an enormous relief on just the issue of uninsurability. But workers' compensation insurance has gone up, all the housing and auto insurance has gone up like everybody else's because the insurance industry has took some hits in the last few years. So, you know, just as our insurance climbs, so do these facilities.
That's a good question. Very good.
Thank you, John.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Well, let's get Jessica Stevens and Marcia Kelly up, please.
I'm going to go first. We pre-decided that.
Fine.
My name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition. Our members include the American Association of University Women of Oregon, with approximately 3,000 members, Delta Kappa Gamma, which is a education honorary sorority made up of retired and current school teachers, with approximately 4,000 members in the state, Oregon Women's Political Caucus, the Older Women's League of Oregon, the Oregon National Association for Women, and the Salem YWCA. Many of our members live in far reaches of the state, like Lakeview, Nyssa, Pendleton, John Day. So we are not just an I-5 organization. I'm here just to do a general plea for the area of children's, adults, and families. In the 2001-2003 regularly legislatively approved budget, about $20 million of general fund was cut from that program, and then the cuts have continued. And from what I can see, there's somewhere in the range of $40 to $60 million worth of cuts in that area on the pages in front of you. Family stability is very important for community stability, and the funding that goes to these areas and the money that goes to the service providers in these areas circulates in the economy just like money from private business. The people who provide services and the people who get money to buy services, that money goes to the local grocery store, the local car dealer, the lumber yard, the clothes retailer. And community stability can be helped with the services some of the newest things that I've been reading on the national economy indicate that we are coming out of our recession slower because of the cutbacks in government-provided services and government jobs, and that if, because government is a part of the community thread. The community weaves together the public and the private. And when you drastically cut the public element in smaller communities, especially, but in every community, you affect the economy detrimentally. So the thing that I'm pleading for is to take a look at what cuts to the nonprofits, to the counties who are providing services, and the cuts just to people to buy food due to the rest of the economy in that city, because as the dollars flow, the private businesses do better. And I will leave you with just one thought, and it's the thought that I look at every day when I walk in the building. It's inscribed on the left-hand side as you walk in the front door of the Capitol on Court Street. A free state is formed and maintained by the voluntary union of the whole people joined together under the same body of laws for the common welfare and the sharing of benefits justly apportioned. Thank you for having this hearing.
Thank you very much. Ms. Stevens.
Chair Schrader and members of the committee, my name is Jessica Stevens, and I'm an organizer with SEIU, Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. We represent about 6,000 employees in DHS, and we want to first thank the Special Budget Committee for providing this opportunity for input. And we also want to acknowledge the many hours and tremendous amount of work done by the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on this budget. Oregon has been forced to make devastating cuts to the Department of the Department of Human Services budget, and as passed by the House, House Bill 5030 will begin to dismantle the mortal infrastructure through which we provide services, that of our DHS employees. We are far beyond the point of doing more with less. Cumulative cuts have resulted in real human suffering and death for some of our clients. On a daily basis, as legislators in the subcommittee know, we receive the suicide calls. We tell clients your services have been eliminated. We recently conducted a survey of our membership in DHS, and the results are telling. 34% suffer from stress or depression that interferes with work. 26% are taking medication to cope with stress from work. 40% are not able to do their job well in only a 40-hour week. 33% do not feel fully informed of their role and duties in regards to programs and services. And 55% of those believe that it is due to a lack of time to learn. You have a summary that I'll get to you, I'm sorry, that will describe the rest of the survey and some recommendations that our members have. We will continue to do the best we can for our clients, no matter to what level the services are funded. However, the issues of client service delivery, workload, and workplace stress are inseparable. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you both. Do we get Patty Whitney, Rocky Dellum, and Philip Wong come up, please?
Thank you, Chair Schrader and committee members. I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the director for the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. And the task force has testified many times before your committees this session and others about concern for the high ranking of hunger in our state and how many of these programs in Department of Human Services impact a family's ability to purchase food. I'm here specifically today to talk about the food stamp catch-up FTE, the need for $11 million for additional DHS staff. Our previous speaker spoke eloquently to the impact of workers in DHS having stress from increased caseloads. In the case of food stamps, the numbers have more than doubled in the last 3 years. We now bring in an additional $192 million a year into our state in food stamp benefits that do help local economies, those local grocers, not to mention the families that it provides food for. And we need a corresponding $11 million for staffing to keep up with the increases. We serve about 400,000 people on food stamps now. There are 900,000 in the state eligible. There are a lot more people to reach, and unless we increase staffing, those needs will not be met. And again, those are both jobs that provide for economic growth in local communities, and bringing in those federal dollars also help stimulate the economy. So at the very least, as we're looking at these cuts, many of which will impact a family's ability to purchase food, we should be maintaining a strong bottom level safety net, and food stamps is one of those levels. So I urge you to increase by the full $11 million, which is matched by another $11 million in federal dollars for staffing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Philip Kennedy, along with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, representing 17 Christian denominations with churches all over the state of Oregon. First, I want to begin by thanking you for this opportunity to testify on the Department of Human Services budget. It was something that we did not have the opportunity to do so in the House.
Yeah, I'd like to know more about that.
For my testimony, we would like to focus on hunger, but before I do that, I'd like to sort of lay sort of like the backdrop in which we come here today in our testimony. As many of us are keenly aware, our state is in a crisis. We are in a crisis on several levels. First, there is the economic crisis of joblessness. Our unemployment rate continues to be high at 8.5%, and many have been unemployed for more than a year. Some have lost their homes, health care, and other critical needs. Second, there is the human crisis of the jobless and those least among us who must depend on state assistance to help them get through this difficult time. And without such assistance, many would fall further into poverty or ill health. And finally, there is a moral crisis. Unfortunately, we have not responded to our brothers and sisters, family members, and neighbors in need during this time. And our Christian duty calls upon us to take care of those in need. And sadly, we have struggled to find the necessary resource to fulfill this duty. As a faith-based organization that also runs social services, I can attest to you that the demand for services that are asked of our local faith-based charities, we are at capacity, and we do not have the ability to meet the rising demand. And we can speak from a more specific example. We run an emergency food program in Northeast Portland next to the Redeemer Lutheran Church, and we have seen our numbers grow tremendously over the last year and a half. In fact, our ability to meet all of that need has not been able to be met with just the resources we have, because we too have been affected by the economy. In fact, without the ability of volunteers who have come and helped at the food service that we provide, we would not be able to meet some of the demand. But even with that, we're unable to meet the need for hunger. And many of these folks that come to our food program are people coming for the first time. It is with this moral underpinning that we would like to raise up several programs that target hunger, and I'd like to list them, but then focus on two of these programs. These programs, which you have listed in front of you in a letter that was addressed to the members of the legislature and our governor, signed by both Christian and Jewish faith-based organizations, identify several programs that we believe in the DHS budget has a direct impact on hunger. And they are TANF, that's Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, Employment-Related Daycare, the Jobs Program, General Assistance, Emergency Assistance, and the Medically Needy Program. I'd like to take this time to focus on two of those programs that I mentioned. First, beginning with TANF. And as you know, TANF is a monthly grant to low-income families of children. This grant has not been increased since 1991, not even for inflation. Instead, what we've seen is this grant to low-income families and children decreased. And about 4,000 families will be affected if TANF is not restored in the Department of Human Services budget. And without TANF, it will be much more difficult for these families to get the support they need while looking for work. Furthermore, employment-related daycare, which is the other program I would like to address, assists working families with child care needs below 185% of the federal poverty level. Under the House passed version of House Bill 5030, the DHS budget, the eligibility requirements were reduced to 150% of the federal poverty level. And the co-payments, which were increased during the fifth special session by the amount of $18, were kept. And although we applied the waiver of the first month's co-payment under the House version, the increased co-payment and the tighter eligibility requirements makes it difficult for people in need to be able to utilize this program. Without adequate funding for employment-related daycare, working parents may be forced to quit their jobs in order to care for their children. Restoring the eligibility level to 185% is essential if we are to survive this crisis. Restoring it to 185% of federal poverty level would help at least 446 families regain daycare assistance. And if this body chooses to repeal the copay increase from the fifth special session, we would see an average of 10,071 families see their average copayment reduced. And additionally, 335 families would be able to return to the program. We would like to ask, if you can look in the letter, to bring the copayment down to a minimum of $25. We hope that you consider these corrections and the others that you've heard today and will hear on House Bill 5030 to ensure that the safety net remains in place during this difficult time. And with that, I conclude my testimony and thank you for the opportunity to hold this hearing on this budget.
Thank you very much.
May I, Mr. Chairman, while your next question. Christmas coming, these guys are doing a great job in feeding the needy in our community. They really are.
Appreciate their work.
Chair Schrader and members of the committee, for the record, Rocky Dahl, Legislative Director, Oregon Student Association, and OSA represents over 100,000 students from our seven public universities, OHSU and Lane Community College. And today I'm speaking in support of the restoration of funding for student daycare in House Bill 5030, the Department of Human Services budget. First, I want to give just a brief rundown of what's happened to this program in the past 24 months. In 2001, building off past federal and state funding, the legislature prioritized child care for low-income student parents and approved a budget of $3.3 million, and that's $2.3 million from federal funding and $1 million in state support. This funding would have been critical in increasing access to post-secondary education by serving approximately 433 student families per month. In February 2002, $1 million was cut from the program, and that left approximately 360 families served. After the third special session, another $1 million was cut, and in April of 2002, students were notified that they may be losing the grant. After August 28th, students were told that the program would end at the end of September, and that left a lot of students scrambling to find either child care, funding for their child care, or leaving their education. So, there were 181 families that were still receiving the grant when it ended, and there was around 1,700 that were on the waiting list. An add-back of $1 million for this program now would serve over 100 families and be an important step in rebuilding the program. Too often, student families are forced to choose between providing care for their children or receiving an education. There's rising costs in education as well as the rising costs of securing quality child care for children. In these times, in the budget crisis, families are told to choose between public assistance or finding child care for their children or turning away from education. We feel that the student child care block grant is an important solution for this problem. It increases access and affordability in education, it reduces the reliance on public assistance, and it creates social and economic returns for the state. Investing in student parents has a lot of long-term benefits. Workers who receive a bachelor's degree earn up to 75% more than workers with a high school diploma. Children who receive quality child care generate $3 to $7 for every dollar invested, and they're more likely to attend college if their parents had received a degree. They'll have higher lifetime earnings, lower rates of unemployment, fewer teen pregnancies, lower crime rates, and fewer incarcerations. Assisting student parents is a short-term investment and a long-term investment for Oregon. Restoring the block grant is important to students and the state. In this time of unemployment, we more than ever need to increase our workforce to get an educated workforce. There's a larger number of unemployed families and a larger number of families that are turning to education. And restoring this program will help them achieve that goal. And we support any proposals to reinvest in this program. We appreciate all the work that you guys have done and allowing us to come in and testify on this today. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony. Good testimony.
Thank you.
Question, Senator Wynn.
No, I don't have a... Well, everybody knows that I support
the position. Rumor has it
that that's Senator Wynn. But before... I would like to ask Jessica, if I may, Jessica Stevens, come up, because I do have a question on her handout, if that's all right, Mr. Chair.
That'd be fine. We'll have Catherine White and Janine Delaney also come up at that time. Thank you.
Jessica, I just started reviewing your survey results, and if you could provide us with how many responded to the survey, and also if you could break down by agency some of these statistics, because some of them are very, very alarming, and as their subcommittee chair, I'm interested in a lot more detail, particularly the one that talks about there's 11% of the workers out of the 56 that have been assaulted. So I would appreciate a breakdown of the number of respondents and by agency, if you could.
Chair Schrader and Senator Winters, thank you for your attention to this. I don't have the numbers at my fingertips now, but I can get a breakdown for you of
could
both
you?
Of those.
I would appreciate
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Go right ahead.
Okay, I'll begin. For the record, my name is Janine Delaney. I am the Director of the Oregon Disabilities Commission and also here as a member of the Human Services Coalition today. And I've been asked specifically to talk about the impact of not funding levels 12 through 14 for seniors and people with disabilities in that program. And I know you're inundated with words, and I tried to think of a way that I could help make these people come to life. And I thought about myself as a person with disability. And most of you would probably think blindness is a pretty darn significant disability and hope that you would never get it. And yet I would not be eligible for these services. These are people who need help ambulating, walking from place to place, eliminating, I don't think we want to go into that one, and eating, not just meal prep, but actually getting the food in their mouth and keeping it there. It could be because they need cueing, they've lost appetites and failed to eat. There are so many reasons. These people are already marginalized by their disability. They're marginalized by their poverty. They lack other family supports and have nowhere else to go. So if we say to them that we recognize this and yet fail to fund the services that keep them alive and safe and as independent as they can possibly be with the significant disabilities and impacts they have in their lives, then what are we saying to people? I just hope to help you understand that these are not people with insignificant disabilities and needs. They're people who depend on this legislature, on all of us, to make decisions that will continue to support the very marginal lives that they have. I acknowledge the work that you've done and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here with the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. And I wanted to first address the Staley settlement and thank this legislative body for the support that you have provided for the settlement. As you know, the settlement agreement addresses the people with developmental disabilities in the developmental disabilities system who have been are Medicaid eligible and had been denied access to services and were put on long wait lists. This budget funds the renegotiated settlement agreement, and I just want to say that the renegotiated settlement agreement recognized the dire circumstances, financial circumstances of Oregon. This settlement agreement does in fact require some extreme sacrifices on the part of developmental people with developmental disabilities, and I just want you to be aware of that. For example, under the funding that is in this budget, only 20 families whose caregivers are over the age of 75. These are individuals over the age of 75 who are still providing 24/7 care for their children, adults, with disabilities, will receive residential services. So we do appreciate the funding for this renegotiated settlement agreement, and we do want to make you aware that this was done with great sacrifice. We are still waiting for the settlement agreement to be signed. The other issue that has been kind of under the radar that I just wanted to quickly draw your attention to is the 50% reduction in family support services. This is a program that was begun in the mid-80s and was designed to reduce the number of children who were forced to go into out-of-home care because their families were unable to provide the care that these children required. And I've sent a handout. It is about a 50% reduction in services that serve less than 25% of the eligible families. So we're getting down to very small numbers of families receiving this assistance, and we would appreciate any possibility of your putting this on any list for attention. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. We're going to go hopefully till 10:30. We've got four more I think we'll see right now, and then we will be reconvening at 1:30 this afternoon for those that haven't had a chance to testify so far. I'm sorry we can't fit everyone in, but we do have caucuses, and we have to get to the floor here pretty soon. But we will be back, and I hope all of you will be back also. Could we get Joy Sars, Courtney Dresser, Dr. Austin, and Ellen Lowe to come forward, please? I'd just like to comment on the last bit of testimony. I am very impressed with the willingness of our disabled population who sacrificed a lot over the years and have gone through a lot of turmoil and changes. They're willing to sacrifice one more time and work with the state in our typical economic times and understanding our plight. And I just hope they understand which we are trying to understand theirs as best we can. And actually, I've been impressed overall with the whole Human Services Coalition in terms of understanding we have tough economic times and trying to prioritize as difficult as that can possibly be for them, the advocates that they are with the services that are most important to Oregonians. And I thank the whole committee for the tenor of the conversation we've had this session. It's been very productive. I'm sorry, go ahead.
For the record, my name is Courtney Dresser. I'm the Oregon Advocacy Manager for the American Cancer Society. In the House-approved budget of DHS, they have zeroed out the tobacco use reduction account. In doing that, they have eliminated the tobacco prevention and education program. This is a voter-mandated program that's been voted on twice by Oregonians, and the American Cancer Society is asking for full funding or as much funding as possible for this program. I understand there are several members of this committee and other senators and representatives who are working to try to get the program to the governor's revised budget number. Since the creation of the program, we have 75,000 fewer adult smokers. We have 47% fewer eighth graders picking up the habit. Tobacco is still the most preventable cause of death. 87% of all lung cancers are due to tobacco use or secondhand smoke. In July, the Federal Trade Commission reported on the marketing dollars spent by the tobacco industry. In 2001, the tobacco industry spent $11 billion on marketing alone. That's more than the state has to spend in 2 years for their budget. In Oregon, they spent $137 million marketing their products to youth and underserved populations. Without a program to counter these massive dollars, more people, young and old, will become smokers, and it will cost this state dollars and lives. The American Cancer Society asks that you look at some form of funding this program and know that this program is cigarette dollars. It's tax revenue from the cigarette purchase of cigarettes. It is not general fund dollars.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Schrader and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity. I want to address you today to urge you to reinstate the tobacco prevention and education program in the DHS budget for this biennium. My name is Don Austin. I'm a physician, board certified in preventive medicine. I volunteer time to serve as chair of TOFCO, the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon. And I emphasize that I don't have any personal benefit nor does TOFCO from the DHS budget. There's one major point I want to make to you today, and that is that TPEP, the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program, saves money, and it saves state money, money that could be used for safety net services. Second point is TPEP is successful. It does save money. It does save lives. And while some believe that the benefit of a tobacco education prevention cessation program is some far-off benefit in the future, and while it does create a benefit in the future, I want to emphasize that there is also an immediate benefit. There is a benefit that occurs within days. And these benefits accrue from decreased exposure to tobacco smoke, both primary and secondary exposure. The effects of these exposures cause things like childhood respiratory infections, increase the risk of SIDS, increase the complications of pregnancy, such as low birth weight babies, which is one of the primary causes of the use of neonatal ICU units and their costs. And it also causes acute heart attacks. And we have had a demonstration just recently this year of a very cleverly done study in Helena, Montana, that demonstrated a 60% reduction in acute myocardial infarctions within 6 months of the program. For the six-month period following a program of smoking bans in Helena, the acute myocardial infarction rate in residents or occupants of Helena reduced by 60%, and then when the ban was lifted, it went back up again. It does have an immediate effect, an effect that can be realized within a biennium. So TPEP does reduce the cost for the single largest cause of preventable death and illness in our population and their expenses. And I point out that the state still pays for many of the safety net services for the most vulnerable in our population, the impoverished and those people with disabilities, and it does pay for prenatal care and neonatal care in those populations. There are 2,200 fewer pregnant smokers per year than there was in 1996. Eighth-grade smokers, as been mentioned, is down by 47% and 75,000 fewer adults smoking since 1996. Now, California also had a successful program, and in the late 1990s, the funds for that program were redirected. And as you might guess, the prevention and education and cessation effects stopped, and the prevalence of smoking, instead of declining, turned around and began to increase again, therefore incurring additional costs with death and disease. And we don't need to repeat that experiment here in Oregon. TPEP was created by Measure 44. That's the will of the people. So as you struggle now to cover the services that are really seriously needed with too few dollars, remember that investing in a successful TPEP program returns more dollars than it costs. And the added benefit is a reduction in illness and death. So I urge you to restore the TPEP budget. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joy Suarez. I work for Care Oregon. I'm here today to support the health care safety net. Those are the clinics that primarily see the Oregon Health Plan clients as well as the uninsured. They're in every county. They're school-based health centers, rural health centers, federally qualified health centers, and community health clinics. They are the backbone of the Oregon Health Plan. Care Oregon is the largest Oregon Health Plan contractor.
Although safety net clinics only make up 15% of our provider panel, they see over 50% of our members. Without the safety net clinics, Oregon Health Plan patients will have a difficult time accessing primary and preventive care. In addition, these clinics see the uninsured. They see them on a sliding fee scale. However, if they do not have the money to be seen, they do not turn these patients away. These are the clinics where kids go to get their immunizations, to get their ears checked. It's where women go to get their prenatal care. It's where families go to get their health care. And as we heard earlier testimony last session, money was allocated. However, it was the safety net clinics did not receive the money. And because the economic downturn, the safety net clinics are overrun. They're at capacity. With the increase in the unemployment rate, with the decrease in compensation from the Oregon Health Plan, as well as the spike in uninsurance, these clinics are overwhelmed. They're unable to absorb the cost shift from all of these factors. Without additional funding, clinics will close. Their ability to provide primary and preventive care to patients in their communities decreases unnecessary emergency room visits as well as unnecessary hospitalizations. And it also decreased the cost shift to privately insured Oregonians. The safety net is asking for $20 million, which is $20 for each uninsured patient. Obviously, this does not cover the full cost of care. However, the safety net clinics are working in partnership with the clients as well as their communities to raise money to help pay for the cost of their care. But it doesn't cover their budget. They need support from the state, from you, in order to keep their doors open. And the good news is that this money is matchable. So it's another reason why supporting the healthcare safety net is good for Oregon's economy and a wise investment. So I urge you to support the healthcare safety net and so we can keep our clinics open, so Oregonians will have a place to access healthcare, so we can have a healthy workforce, healthy families, and healthy kids. Do you have any questions?
Very good. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Ms. Lowe, want to come forward?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to come back at 1:30.
You come right up here. We're okay. You're part of an entourage that has done a very, very excellent job. Not your family here. No pressure.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I appear today as a member of the Health Services Coalition and also on behalf of the Oregon Law Center and the Oregon Food Bank and the low-income Oregonians who come to us for assistance. We are concerned about the availability, the funding, and the quality of services to low-income Oregonians. We hear from folks at a time of need and fewer remedies. This has become a time of instability for families and the programs designed to serve them. Transient has become a descriptor of our neediest. Unfortunately, the support services may be just as transient. As you develop a structure to measure the consequences of your actions, we ask that you pay special attention to both the human and physical costs of suspending or curtailing services with subsequent increased startup costs. As 5030 came to you, we do not believe the Oregon Health Plan meets its statutory or its health care obligations. The capitation at $71,000 for the standard population may seem adequate in light of the rapidly decreasing number of Oregonians in the standard population, but we see that there could well be a return to the plan when chemical dependency and mental health are returned as benefits. If you are below the poverty level, you may question the advisability of paying a premium for benefits that exclude the services for which you have the most need. So we do anticipate increased enrollment. This could lead quickly to reaching the cap and the formation of a queue of folks whose health status demand immediate and continuing attention. We also wish to highlight the negative impact of the size of the premium, the required monthly payment, and the six-month penalty for lapsing. This is a population where a permanent mailing address and a bank account is not the norm. I've often called them my unorganized. They are a call for us as a community to provide a structure that serves. The current health plan financial requirements fall far short. They do not provide a remedy. Now, we heard Mr. Bishop talk about the hospital provider tax deliberations, and we sincerely hope these discussions lead to the restoration of hospital services for the standard population. Hospitals are part of the health care delivery system. The standard population does not limit healthcare needs to conditions that exclude the need for a hospital setting. To exclude hospitals would shift the ultimate cost to those of us who will pay as a result of the cost shift. The costs will also be higher because of the likely delay for treatment. And as you have the opportunity to participate in these deliberations with the hospitals, we ask that you seek ways of stabilizing community-based systems of integrated, coordinated health care. And you just heard Joy describe how safety net clinics are very much part of that integrated system. We ask that you then look at this tax as a way of funding these services. You've had several folks mention the health systems planning function, which is currently part of the health cluster. And I really want to contrast what is happening in terms of their service for providing integration to address all across the board the needs of special populations with what we used to have, where we had silos in so often in the former health division. I also want to address general assistance. We need a new name because it's been reduced to a very narrow, specific life support for Oregon's neediest. And I will acknowledge that the current proposal narrows it even more. Early in the session, we acknowledge that it would be necessary to make some adjustments in order to add programs that were excluded from the governor's budget because of the defeat of Measure 28. General assistance was a program where we worked with the department, your legislative fiscal office, other advocates, and some of you to design a very minimum program. And this absolute bottom level of support didn't make it into House Bill 5030A. General assistance, as proposed, would provide $314 a month as recipients await their certification for SSI. When the GA folks apply for this assistance, they sign a form saying that they will, that when they are awarded SSI, the state is going to be reimbursed out of the SSI payment. So you can characterize the initial general assistance as a float, as a loan. From SSI recoveries, it is projected that there are going to be $6.2 million coming back to the state this biennium. Now, remember, to be eligible for general assistance, you can't have more than $50 in cash, $1,500 in resources, and it isn't just that you're unemployed, you're unemployable. And there is a difference. Oregon's neediest are endangered, really, with the budget that's before you. And so we seek the restoration of the $3.9 million. You have heard from a number of spokespersons this morning from the social service delivery system areas traditionally included in the Department of Human Services. Unfortunately, many of these services are absent or significantly reduced in House Bill 5030A. We acknowledge that political realities will not allow you to address all of the unmet needs on our list. So we ask that you reflect upon the role of the triage nurse in urgent care. A few are shifted to emergency care. Some receive appointments for a future time, and the others are scheduled that day or evening as their needs dictate. You, in effect, are the triage for Oregon's most vulnerable. We ask that you build on the work started by the Ways and Means Human Services Subcommittee so you can discern the relative needs of vulnerable Oregonians and the community-based institutions that serve them. Your decisions to delay a few services can be understood by all of us. If choices for restoration are visible, we do believe that you have the skills, that you have the knowledge, and maybe more importantly, the understanding to exercise thoughtful triage. We thank you for this hearing so those of you who weren't on the subcommittee can begin the process that Senator Gordley and Senator Carter have been part of. And we give you our support and our trust. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ellen. Very good testimony. Well, we've got floor here in a little bit. Appreciate everyone's good words this morning. Hopefully I have more good words this afternoon. We'll reconvene here. We'll recess till 1:30.
Hang it in there, please.
We'll reopen the public hearing on House Bill 5030A. Appreciate people's patience. There's some people that have to get back home here shortly, so I'm going to jump to them, ask them to come forward. That'll be Mike Levine, Deborah Olson, Harlan Patterson, and then a couple more here in just a second. Thank you for your patience today. Appreciate it very much. Okay.
Chair Schrader and committee, number one, thank you for letting us come here today. I'm going to keep my statements really brief. Most of you have heard from me almost daily, for sure weekly. I still have a little bit of a problem, or actually a major problem, with the House's budget. I still am asking for, and I hope that you all will try to come up with the revenues for full restoration of all cuts. And I know that's asking for a lot, and I know from what I heard today, everybody's looking for pieces for their groups and so forth and so on. I've been asked several different times walking the halls here by different legislators what I thought my priorities would be. And I can't answer. I don't want to be the one to say who lives or who dies. I don't want to be the one to say you have quality of life or you don't. I know that's putting a lot on your heads. But again, and Senator Gordley, what was it, 3-4 months ago, you were talking about Article 9, where it was the responsibility for revenues to be raised. And that touched me when you said that, and I really believe in that. And we are talking about the most vulnerable people in this state, and we're talking about a state that was known for years and years for taking care of its most vulnerable. And where are we going to end up? I don't know where you're going to find the money, and I'm certainly glad I'm not sitting in your seats, but the monies need to be found. The constituents throughout the state that do not believe that new taxes are necessary need to be educated. We try as advocates to educate. I'm hoping that you all, as legislators, will try to educate your constituents that you're not voting for taxes just to tax, but they're necessary. And again, thank you, and I think I'm just going to leave my comments at that.
Very good, Michael. Thank you.
Hello, committee members. My name is Deborah Olson. I live at 1218 Southwest Washington Street, apartment 509 in Portland, and I do hope you find the money to raise the revenues. If my mother was alive today, I believe she would be in one of two situations. The first situation, she would be in maximum security institution, or two, she would be homeless. Before she was institutionalized for the last time, she was living in a three-bedroom apartment. The rest of the apartment was shared with two other persons. There was a refrigerator, and the stove was taken out for the safety of the residents. There were three meals a day cooked in a community service area. The three residents shared a living room, the kitchen, the bathroom, and these three people shared a basic apartment. They came and they went as they pleased. They did not have to take their medications. If they didn't want to eat there, they did not have to. And one day my mother fell asleep and started a fire with a lit cigarette. And that's when she was put into maximum security, what I call prison, but it was an asylum. Here are a few examples of the budget cuts. Yeah, the first one was Marcia Katz. She has been here before. She had to go back into surgery. She is one of the medically needy. She did not get the physical therapy that she had needed, and just last week she went back into the OR for them to try to correct the damage that had been done after her knee replacement surgery. She could not bend it more than 120 degrees, so there was definitely no savings there for a second ER visit, or excuse me, operation. Marie Stern is a 46-year-old lady. She lost her mental health services during the budget cuts. Approximately 35 days ago, the Marion County Police took her to the state hospital right down the street. She was committed for 180 days. She got out just last Saturday, the 8th or the 9th, after 25 days of being institutionalized. I see no savings there. Pat Reinhart needs housekeeping services and help, and she needs help shopping to stay in her home. She is now in a wheelchair. She's 61. She lives a floor below me. Judy Fleming, I have mentioned before, had mental health issues. She worked part-time. She could not afford her medications. She killed herself November of 2002. Shortly after that, another lady named Bernadine took over her job. I don't know what happened to Bernadine. She disappeared about a month ago. I'm going to guess she probably couldn't afford her medications after working part-time for a while. Eugene Moreau is still not getting his needles and insulin on a steady basis. He's 69. Tammy needs housekeeping services. She's lost her mental health support. She's almost over the edge. She's ready to have herself committed to the hospital now. She's thinking of suicide. She's 43. Viola Cloud is 72. She still cannot afford a celebration, which is $100 a month for her arthritic pain. Glenda is in her 40s. She was on GA. She was cut off, and she's now homeless. She's on a waiting list to get in the shelter. She is deaf and has many other health problems. These are some of the stats with names and faces. I don't have the lots of stats or to tell you how much it costs to take care of them. Mary Parker has mental health problems. She tried to help her daughter out by babysitting. That lasted less than 30 days. Mary has crashed. She has no mental health coverage because she's on OHP standard. Mary's 52. She's also a neighbor of mine in Rosenbaum Plaza. Rick Berger, I'm sure some of you must remember him. He's in a wheelchair. He can't get here. He hasn't been able to get around for 4 to 5 months. His wheelchair stopped running, and he can't get a replacement. He cannot walk very far. He's diabetic. Now, Liz and Rico. Liz is a 32-year-old mother. Rico is now 8. They get $375 a month GA. They're homeless. They're staying with friends on a couch. Now, years ago, I've heard about the safety net, and years ago when I went on maternity leave, I went from $300 a week to $80 a week maternity leave. I had to sign up for food stamps. I walked up to the window and cried. I was very humiliated. Very humiliated. That in 1984, I was laid off. I was working in Clackamas County in a manufacturing plant. I'd heard of the county clinic in Clackamas County, where I could take my son for his shots. His those ones that you get for tetanus, ear infections and stuff. I was not aware that Multnomah County even had a safety net clinic back then. So the safety nets definitely need to be funded. I lived in Multnomah County, and I was going to Clackamas County because somebody in Clackamas County told me I could take my child there. I'm not a social worker. I do not have stats. I am a donor. I am a voter. Right offhand, I was writing this today. I just got short notice about coming here last night. Three persons that I can think of right off the bat have died in my building since February. Many more of my neighbors are not affording their medications. They are buying cheap booze to self-medicate themselves and to help with some of the pain. One gentleman cut his foot and bled to death about 2 months ago. His neighbors were worried. None of them had known that they could call 911 and have a wellness check done. He was found 6 days later. Dale died just last week. He just passed on. I don't know if it was because of complications from diabetes, or it was just his time to go. The next day, the cleaning lady found him blue. Patty was lucky. She got to go into the hospice before February. She died February 15th. I got there about 7 hours too late to say goodbye to her. More of my neighbors are becoming recluse. They're regressing. I've talked to some people in the neighborhood. They haven't even applied for OHP because of the budget cuts. And they are entitled. I talked to two women who are volunteering at Sisters of the Road Friday. Both of them are bipolar. And they said, well, they have no money. We're not going to get the funding. Raise the revenue. I used to say if I could afford a Jag, put on an exercise tax. If I could afford a Honda, put on an excise tax.
Very good.
Thank you.
Very good testimony. Thank you very
much. Good afternoon. I'm Karen Patterson. I dare to only tell you my own personal story. My husband's not here. He has had a stroke about 3 years ago. I am a diabetic. I am taking care of both of us. I'm supposedly always standard. He is on the plus plan. That's the way it was set up. I worked for 16 years for the state as a care provider. I no longer can do that. I am a diabetic. What my biggest expense is that we have to pay out of his Social Security check, all my co-pays. I am trying for Social Security for myself. So far, I have a lawyer. That's where it lays right now. I don't know if I'm going to get it or not. All we're doing is trying. My test strips alone cost us $72 a month. Everything else goes down in price, but still more than what we really can afford to do. I don't know what else to tell you. If you have any questions, I'll gladly answer. But
that's very pointed. Thank you. Very good. Thank you very much. Let's get some more up here. Fran Lanfer and Jan Campbell, can you come forward, please?
Mr. Chair, Fran had to leave, but thank you very much.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's
you'd like someone to come up with you, Jan? How about we have some others coming? Paul Nielsen, perhaps, and Paul Potter, if they're still here. You can start, Jan, if you'd like.
Okay. Good afternoon. Today I'm not going to be speaking as an individual, but I'm going to be speaking as chair of the Multnomah County Disability Services Advisory Council. And we advise on policy and programs, et cetera, for aging and disability services in Multnomah County. And I'd like to tell you a little about how the cuts have affected persons with disabilities in Multnomah County. Out of Multnomah County, 1,100 individuals have lost long-term care. These services promote independence and dignity and help keep people, persons with disabilities, out of nursing homes. Another 2,100 individuals have services reduced through the Oregon Health Plan, and this means prescription drugs, et cetera, and we've heard stories and stories of how that's affected persons with disabilities. 1,955 individuals were cut from the medically needy program, and many of these people are working and they have significant illnesses. And if they have to stop working, then it's going to be eventually they'll have to get on Medicaid. And I think, again, what needs to be done is that we need to look at the program and more streamlining and try to maybe revamp it so that it's more cost effective. Because, again, that's a service that's very program needed. Then we also have 1,090 people have lost medical assistance. This program provides the poorest of the poor small cash. It pays for itself. Approximately 80% of the cost can be recouped from the feds. And a couple of incidences I would like to tell you that I know about personally because I work in the disability. I'm also the disability project coordinator for the city of Portland and Multnomah County. And one was Rick Berger, and I know you all know Rick Berger. His chair did go out, and he tried to get another chair, and now he's not able to get a motorized chair. So all he has now is a manual chair, and he's been homebound for months and months because he cannot get out anymore. There is another young man that I've worked with that lost his housekeeping and personal care, and we've had to put him into an adult foster care. And then you can also go out on the steps and read about the lives that have been lost. And these are just a few of the examples, and you can go on and on. If you go into downtown Portland, you can see so many people with disabilities and seniors on the streets. And one of the issues that we have, and I'm sure all over Oregon, is especially for people with mobility impairments, that the shelters or places where some people may be able to find housing are not accessible. So we see people in wheelchairs. I live down by the waterfront, and I see people in wheelchairs actually trying to find places by restaurants where they can plug in their motorized wheelchair and then they spend the night on the ground. So these are just a few of the things that I wanted to share with you. And we have worked so hard to try to keep people out of institutions and to keep them in the community. And we have a death with dignity, and I think we now need to think about life with dignity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Okay. Senator Schrader and members of the committee, first of all, my name is Paul Potter, and I reside at 5123 Southeast Wilma Circle, Milwaukee, Oregon. I want to thank the committee for having this public testimony today. I know that this unprecedented length of the legislature this year and having the dubious distinction of being the only state in the union is yet to have a budget weighs heavy on all of you, and I think a lot of hard work has been done, and I know there's still some work to go. And so my remarks today are really somewhat general in nature and ones that are sort of echoing what people have already said very eloquently here today. But our organization is Cascadia Behavioral Health Care, and I'm also a member of the Alcohol and Drug Program Managers Association of Oregon as well. And so we provide both mental health, gambling addiction treatment, and alcohol and drug services in Multnomah County, Washington County, and Marion County. So those are the areas of concern that I have, as both primarily in alcohol and drug, gambling addiction treatment, and mental health. The proposed add-backs that this House bill has in them help and get us somewhat in the general direction of where we need to be. But my main concern regarding the levels of the budget that are being proposed is that facing the massive and draconian cuts that we had 3 to 6 months ago, these restorations may appear that, you know, that we've got, you know, that they're, you know, they've saved the day, when in fact it's only getting us partway back to where we need to be. I just want to sort of reemphasize that. I know that you're many of you understand that and know that. And the difficult area, of course, is how are we going to find the money for that? And I think that, as others have testified, finding new areas of revenue is going to be really very, very important. I would really urge you to look at the excise tax on beer and wine that's been proposed. It's a very solid proposal. And dedicated to alcohol and drug and mental health and public safety, can really go a long ways to helping add to the budget that's currently being proposed. So those are some areas that I would urge that you take a look at. We have been assaulted, really, with major cuts over the last 2 years, and I can tell you that anecdotally, that I can see, just as you've heard here this morning, is that there's a lot of people who have kind of patched together their lives and are sort of hanging out, you know, waiting for the other shoe to fall. And it's only a matter of timing, I think, before we're going to see lots more individuals hit higher levels of care. They're going to be seen in the emergency room. They're going to be end up in jail. They're going to be in the hospital at much higher levels of care. I think that, you know, I just want to commend the legislature this year for really, I think, very much getting the notion that if we don't fund these services, that we're going to pay for them in a lot more expensive, higher levels of care. But let me urge you not to go part way, because if you only go part way, then my fear is that you won't achieve the savings that you're out after, and that is a very well-intentioned direction that you're headed. So I'm both encouraged and cautiously urging you to try to do as much as you can to go all the way with the savings. Restore. We really need to have the Oregon Health Plan restored to its full capacity. It's going to be somewhat difficult, I think, to cap that at 71,000 is the last numbers that I was hearing. In terms of how you do that, it's going to be pretty tricky, I think. So that really is, I just want to end on a kind of a personal note, is that I'm struck each day that I do this work about how small our community is. It's that I really got into this work of managing alcohol and drug programs through my own recovery in 1980, and so I'm a product of our system, and the help was there for me when I needed it then. I worry that it isn't always available for people who need it now, and what we're missing in terms of in our future, in terms of people who can be future leaders and helpers and supporters and productive members of society. So, and I had a brother who lived in Marion County, and at the same time that I was managing a detox and residential program, and our programs weren't able to help him for whatever reasons those are, and he died here in Marion County as a result of alcoholism. And so, you know, to me it's very personal, and for many people who are doing this work, it's very personal work. So, and I know you all know that. You have demonstrated that time and time again. These are difficult times, and I urge you to look at the issues carefully and really do everything we can to go all the way with fully funding the Oregon Health Plan. Thank you. I'll take any very questions. Much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Nielsen, and I am representing today Well Partner Incorporated, which is a newcomer to the Oregon scene in terms of the Oregon Health Plan and Medicaid. Well Partner is a wholly owned and operated plan in Oregon for the delivery of prescription drugs to your home, and it has won the fee-for-service bid for the Medicaid population here in Oregon. And I want to pick up on a couple of Mr. Potter's comments about getting the savings that would be helpful to the plan. And I also want to defend and explain the budget line that lists the savings that Well Partner and the mail order business can bring to the Oregon Health Plan. First of all, it asks for it says that there should be a 30% usage figure for the fee-for-service population, and that is what the budget line savings is based on. And we didn't just pull this number out of the air. We asked around and asked experience from other plans. From Oregon Health Sciences University has 22% of their prescriptions now being dispensed as mail order. Other private entities, IBM, for example, requires mail order for some of their chronic prescriptions. And so we felt that 30% of chronic prescriptions, which relates to a figure of a total of 18% of all prescriptions, because 60% are chronic. So that's where that number comes from, in case you have questions when you see that coming forward. Now, mail order has, you know, to some people been offered as a good thing. To other people, it represents an impartial, impersonal form of healthcare delivery. And so I'd like to address both of those things. In the, let me first say that the pharmacists that are employed by WellPartner once worked for AARP. And so when they moved back east, those employees became employees of an Oregon-based company and were able to keep those jobs here in Oregon by virtue of that act. So first and foremost, this is a business that is run and operated by Oregonians. Now, the other side of this, the human side of this, is that the allusions to the problems of the disabled and the transportation issues and the whole issue of the dignity that you have when you're a person that's afflicted with a disease or disability, a lot of that has to do with your independence. And mail order pharmacy does offer the people the way to pick up the phone and still be in control of that aspect of their therapy. WellPartner sent out an encouragement through the state's auspices of people in the state to get them to use more mail order, because the difference in reimbursement is 6%. So the state saves 6% on every prescription brand name that goes out mail order. And it was very warming to get comments back from the patients asking if this cost the state money or saved the state money, and they wanted to know, and they wanted to use the service if it saved the state money. So I'm just making a note that the people in the plan are quite aware of the budget issues, and they are themselves looking for ways to help the state save those costs. And for this reason, I just wind up by asking you to stay with the percentage target figure that's in the budget. There needs to be an objective there for the agency to use. This is way short of a mandate that was placed in the original workup in 2001, but it is more than just a simple encouragement that finally resulted in very little savings through this valuable tool. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you all. Let's see. Can we get Frank Fryer, Bill Olson, and Jeffrey Davis, if he's still here, to come forward?
Chairman Olson just submitted testimony. He had to
leave. All right. We'll get that entered into the record.
Thank you.
Sorry. How about Ellen Penny? Can she come forward if she's still here? Thank you, Ellen. Frank, why don't you start off?
Good afternoon, Chair Schrader and members of the committee. My name is Frank Fryer. I'm the legislative liaison for the Oregon County Veterans Service Officers Association. I'm here to support any additions to the budget, the House budget, possible. I realize that in times like these, where there's a finite amount of money, there's quite a bit of political pressure against any kind of reduction of tax breaks or tax increases of any sort. The problem becomes your choices have to be made, and unfortunately for the members, you are the ones that have to make those choices. And the choices are, what can you get for the money you're going to have to put out, and what's the best way of getting those services provided and maintaining the safety net? Due to other budget cuts, I've been a case manager for the last quarter in Multnomah County. One of the things that I've heard often today is the restoration of levels 11 through 14 or 14 through 17. One thing that bothers me is the one term that's left off of that phrase. It's a survivability level. I go out and do that every day. I check and see the clients that we have at a nursing facility, what their level of care needs are, and how much more we have to give when we have someone in a nursing home rather than an adult care facility or in their own home. The cost in nursing homes is almost $4,000, in some cases more than $4,000 a month. If you keep people into an adult foster home, it's about $1,300 or $1,400 a month. To cut services for people who are on the brink of going into an increased care facility makes no fiscal sense whatsoever. Part of what goes on is, or what I should say, is the difference between a level 14, survivability level 14, and a survivability level 10 is extremely surprising. It could be just a cognitive deficit that could come on at any time. The people in the services section, they generally get evaluated once a year. Someone on the verge of having more deficits who isn't seen for a year usually ends up in a nursing home. It's an extremely cost inefficient way to provide services to those most needy. And in an aside here, there's a House bill I mentioned, 3609, which I am helping to push forward because it does something else. It allows several counties to get veterans benefits for people on Medicare. What that does is substitute federal VA funds for state general funds and state Medicare dollars. It's been proven in a pilot project that we had that it's cost efficient. It's something that can be done with a fairly minimal amount of money. And from the pilot project that ended last November or December, those savings are still being carried on today. So that whenever we get someone into the veterans program, it does save money continuously. Thank you. I'm glad to answer any questions.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for your work.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, question. Senator Harper.
Why was this a pilot project? Why aren't we doing it?
It was a pilot project due to the last legislative session. There was a budget note that was put in to see if it would work. It worked. It was a victim of the end game of the last legislature. The bill came up again here in a different format, and now it's being held up at the Ways and Means Human Services Committee. DHS has said that they support the bill. I don't see any reason not to do it, but I don't control the schedule.
3609, is that correct? Is that the bill number, Mr. Breyer?
3609, House bill.
Why do you need a bill?
We've had problems with the...
With getting the funding released.
From the VA?
No, the pilot project, the initial one, did. Essentially, Multnomah County fronted the money, and then
I'll get with Jackie when we get. You got the answers, Jackie? Okay, I'll get with her later.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
The one thing that I think it's so important for us to hear, and that is, we save money by helping people up front before they go to nursing facilities. Senior services people have been telling us that for years, and everybody else has been telling us that. And somewhere along the line, we need to heed that.
Very good, Ms. Penny.
For the record, my name is Ellen Kinney. I work with the Oregon Health Action Campaign. We really appreciate the agony you must be going through as you try to juggle human and economic need with available revenues and the political will to find additional resources to fund human services and Oregon's educational and human service infrastructure in ways that will result in no more harm being done. We appreciate this hearing and the opportunity to provide input. Here's our input on the Oregon Health Plan. We believe the Oregon Health Plan is worthy of supporting and recognize it as a tool for providing health, for reducing cost shift, for supporting Oregon employers who cannot afford to pay their skyrocketing health care premiums, for helping people get back to work, for keeping people at work, and for bringing in hundreds and thousands of federal dollars. So that's why it deserves to be supported. We appreciate in House Bill 5030 maintaining benefits for categorical eligibles and women and children, the fact that it does recognize the advantages of providing health care to children at a higher income level that's currently being provided up to 200% of the federal poverty level, maintenance of some portion of medically needy, and maintenance of some form of benefits for the Oregon Health Plan standard population. But what's missing first and foremost from our perspective, and probably something that it's been mentioned here before, really, but not in detail, is the impact of the premium policy on the most vulnerable members of the Oregon Health Plan standard population. And I have some numbers that I would just like to share with you, which we did share. Thank you so much. In a letter that went to legislatures earlier. And those numbers show that between March and June of this year, 20,000 people on OHP standard lost coverage. 11,000 of those people who lost coverage live with incomes less than 10% of the federal poverty level. March was the first time that OMAP started tracking data for Oregon Health Plan standard enrollees based on income. And if you look at the charts I just gave you, the data from OMAP, you have March and May here. You see on the back of those charts, they've actually pulled OHP standard out from OMAP, the numbers on the front, and put them on the back, and they divide them by income. So, for example, in March, you have 3,299 families enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan with income less than 10% of the federal poverty level. And you have 32,276 families who do not have children with incomes less than 10% of the federal poverty level enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. And if you look at May's numbers, probably the most significant drop is 10,000. We have 22,000 enrollees in Oregon Health Plan standard adults, couples without children enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. I think the data about kind of the shift in enrollment away from the most vulnerable enrollees in the Oregon Health Plan, a standard population, is alarming and should be, we would ask it be addressed in any budget that goes forward. Specifically, and probably the most direct thing that could happen to impact this is I think the most punitive policy is requiring that people stay disenrolled for 6 months if their premium does not come on time. Prior to March, if people didn't pay their premium, they could re-enroll in the health plan once they had paid their back due premiums in full. You could stay enrolled for a full 6 months. Starting March, if you don't pay your premium in 1 month, you're disenrolled for six. There is no private policy we know of that will not re-enroll you once you have paid your premiums. Plus, with the elimination of presumptive eligibility, if I am disenrolled tomorrow and I reapply the next day, it would still take about 2 months for me to have my enrollment certified and therefore be able to enroll. So there'd still be a wait time. In addition, we have heard countless stories of people who have made really good faith efforts to pay their premiums on time. People who struggle to come up with their little $6.50, put a stamp on their envelope and mail it in 2 weeks in advance from Lincoln County, and in one case from Multnomah County, arrived at William Earhart 3 days too late. The people are disenrolled. And we believe that's probably happening more often than just the stories that we hear about. There are very simple ways to make the premium policy more fair for this population, and one of them is to allow people to pay cash in their communities. Another is to allow agencies that service these clients to be able to call William Earhart, the company in Portland that collects the premiums, and pay with a credit card. There are simple ways for clients to be able to know without a shadow of a doubt what they owe. There's mass confusion out there. There is no number that clients can call that they can get through to on a 24-hour basis that allows them, for example, to learn how much they owe. They have to be able to be in a place where they can get their notice in the mail. And as you can tell from the income level, many of these folks are homeless. And when you live at 10% of federal poverty level, you're probably moving around. In addition, we are very concerned, especially within the confines of this premium policy, with the cap on enrollment. Because what happens with the cap on enrollment is we will systematically start to see, granted 99% of the federal poverty level is an upper income, but we're going to start to see a shift of enrollment away from the most bottom-tiered income levels to higher income levels. We strongly support funding for the safety net, House Bill 2970, because in the context of hundreds of thousands of Oregonians without health insurance, many of whom are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan but unable to enroll or they don't know about the programs, the safety net is the most cost-effective and direct way for people to get access where they live. We are concerned about the erosion of the medically needy program, and clearly we believe that any comprehensive package of benefits should include hospitalization. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Very good.
Chair Schrader, committee members, I am Jeffrey Davis. I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs and the Coalition of Local Health Officials. I would just echo what you've heard already about the hard tasks we have before you, and I do really appreciate the fact that you took the time to come back after this morning's hearing to hear us this afternoon, and I thank you for that very much. I would say that I think HISCO and the document that they presented to you this morning also show not only we talked earlier about the challenges you have in balancing, but the challenges some of your constituents and our citizens of Oregon are going to have no matter how the budget is balanced in the end, because in fact there are trade-offs, and I think the HISCO document did a nice job of identifying where some of those trade-offs are going to be. One of the things at the county level that we struggle with is we tend to look at a lot of what we do locally in each county as a system, because when you stop and think about jails and courts and the local DA, local public health, the local hospital emergency room, mental health, and nonprofit providers, depending on how resources move, costs are shifted back and forth among those various folks at the local level. So, in fact, we can cut back on services in mental health, or we can cut back on services in A&D, but in turn the county ends up paying for it in some way because the jail gets overcrowded, or they end up having more early releases because there are not other resources in the community to look at it. So our struggle is trying to keep that system working as well together as we can in order to assure the most services we can provide with the resources we got available locally, and that's a continuous challenge, and it's probably a microcosm of what you're trying to do on a statewide level, where you're doing it statewide, and each one of us is trying to look at it locally in each county. One of the things that is challenging for us, and I think you've heard this information before, so it's not new, is a result of not only the last legislative session, but all the special sessions in between, we've lost about 1,800 positions within the local system, particularly focusing just on mental health, alcohol and drug, developmental disabilities, and public health. That's both in the county system and in the nonprofit system. Keep in mind, many nonprofit agencies receive lots of resources from you through the counties to them, and they're counted in this number. And that's a significant economic reduction along with the others that are there. With regards to the House budget that's before you, we greatly support the fact that mental health crisis monies, although not fully restored, are back in there. And clearly, that's going to help local communities. It also is clearly going to help local hospitals who are, you've heard from before, are struggling to make ends meet. Well, the fact, if we're involved in the emergency room resolving the mental health issues, they're able then to deal with the medical issues, and that's both good for constituents, but also good for that organization. A huge gap that is filled by the House budget is the restoration of mental health outpatient services for indigents. A huge problem for everybody, and that's positive. We also appreciate the fact that mental health and A&D services for the standard population are back in. Like you've heard earlier, there is a cap on the number. There is some concern about how that cap might impact counties, because if you reach the cap, does the county then supposedly become the default for providing those services should Medicaid OHP money not be available. That is a concern that we have, and that's something that it's just a concern. We have. There's one area in the House budget that to us is a significant problem, and it's something we feel needs to be fixed. And that is, there is about $5 million in their budget for alcohol and drug residential services. There is nothing in the budget for alcohol and drug outpatient services for those who do not qualify for the Oregon Health Plan. And one of the reasons that that's a concern is that if you look at local jails, they will tell you that close to 75, 80, maybe for some it's even higher, percent of the people in there have A&D problems. I know because my daughter works for child welfare that her caseload that she currently carries has about 75% of the adults on her caseload have a substance abuse problem. If they don't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan, or in the case when Standard wasn't there, their kids are pulled, there's no place for that woman or that father to go to get treatment, and yet our state system is trying to do something to restore that family and get that child back, and as you well know, foster homes are difficult to find. So I think from our standpoint, that's a problem that needs to be fixed because it has wide ramifications across the system, whether it's the drug court, whether it's child welfare, whether it's domestic violence, whether it's the emergency room, or whether it's child welfare. That's a big issue. Finally, I would just add that you heard from Catherine Wyatt earlier this morning about DDE family support piece. Just want to echo the fact that that is a early intervention and early support for families with developmentally disabled, and given some of the changes that are occurring in the Staley renegotiated agreement, that's something that does provide support that previously might have been picked up through that agreement. With that, I'll end, and I would answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you very much. Good testimony. Thank you both. Thank you all. Could we get Mary Bodkin, Nan Heim, and Angela Kimball to come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Bodkin. I'm here today representing AFSCME Council 75. I started out by doing testimony that talked about anecdotal horror stories and decided that after sitting through the morning session, I would redo my testimony and instead focus on two different areas that have not been really fully addressed today. And that would be both the employees who work in the facilities, in the group homes, and the group home owners and service providers themselves. We have two very serious problems. One is, and you've heard this over and over again, turnover. Turnover, 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 turnover. It is one of our most horrific problems, is keeping, attracting, and holding on to good employees, because they can go to work in almost any fast food restaurant or any restaurant and make as much or more than they make by working for one of our group home providers. And what I did in the break that the chair gave us was to kind of get on the phone quickly and find out what the wage ranges were for those private providers that we represent, kind of to give you a sense of how low the pay is for these employees, and to explain to you that as I sit here, I have staff colleagues who are in bargaining right now trying to figure out how to, one, keep our group homes open because they live and operate on such a narrow margin, and two, how to keep the employees that they have employed.
and at the same time how to continue to provide some kind of stability for our clients. Early in the session, we brought down a couple of our members to testify, and we didn't do that again because this truly is one of the toughest budget areas we have to deal with, both for our members as well as for staff. It's hard to understand, and it's even more difficult when you are a person working in the system and you see clients that you are responsible for either becoming so unstable that death would be a release, but yet knowing that death is a horrific end to a case that could be otherwise resolved. And so, having said that, there's a couple of things we want to ask you to take a look at. This will be the first session in many sessions that we have not been successful as a union in getting some kind of set-aside for salary increases. Not for our public service side, but for our private sector side. Because the reality is, if our members work in the public sector, they're getting a family wage job, they're getting full benefits, and they're getting retirement. If they're working on the private side, they're barely getting by. And so we really want to ask you to kind of continue the commitment that Senator Hannon has made over the years of trying to reach some kind of parity. You know, we are not foolish people. We understand that parity is a long ways away from anything that is obtainable right now. But if this committee can find some money somewhere to set aside some funding for a 25 or a 50 cent increase over the next 2 years for this small group of employees who work in the public, in the private sector of this area, it would be helpful. And the other thing, if we find the money, the other thing we want to tell you is you've got to tell them what it's for. You cannot hand the providers a check and expect that it will get into the employee paycheck. In one case, we had to sue the employer to get the money to give to the employees that one legislature set aside specifically for that. And we did finally get it. The other thing, and I want to say this very quickly, most of the agencies that are on this list are very responsible, very caring, and work very well with us as their union and with their employees. We have a couple of employers that we deal with that can always find $40,000 or $50,000 to put into a lawyer's pocket but can't ever find enough money to pay the employees a nickel more. We think you ought to make sure they're not spending their money that way, or not spending your money that way. There are alternative dispute resolution processes. You know, ERB provides training. You know, there's a lot of people who do alternative dispute resolution training. We're more than willing to do that. This idea that they have to hire some lawyer out of Lake Oswego to bargain a contract is crazy, especially when they charge what they do. Then, finally, the other issue that really haunts us every day is the ability to even buy insurance. And I'm not talking about liability insurance. I'm talking about health care. You know, there are so few health care agencies now that are willing to sell health care insurance to this client, to this employee base, and to these employers, that there's no shopping around anymore. You take it or you leave it. And a lot of our members are women, and they are single moms. And as you can tell, several of these employers, the employee has to pay for family insurance. They get their insurance covered, but they have to pay for family coverage. Well, they have children. Their children are either going to be on the Oregon Health Plan or they're not going to have anything. And this is craziness to us. We have to figure out a way to broaden the base so that there is more competition in this wonderful free market enterprise that we have for health insurance, and make sure that somebody provides access to health care for this group. And having said that, I think those are kind of some of our areas of concern. I mean, we have concerns about all the client issues that you've heard all morning, all day, that you're going to continue to hear about. But I just thought somebody ought to, like, jump in and say, you know, we've got a whole bunch of folks out there that are just barely making it, and they provide some pretty critical services to a very risky and needy population. And we are their last best hope. And if we don't survive this, and if our employers don't survive this, I'm not sure what happens to those clients. You know, there's a question about whether or not is the county the provider of last resort. Do they have the ultimate responsibility? I think they do. You know, I'm looking at a budget and saying, okay, we have a $6 million set aside for Staley. I think Staley's a great settlement. If we don't have any providers left who are in business because they can't make ends meet, what good is $6 million in a set-aside for Staley to pay for services to a wait list of people who are going to go to something that doesn't exist? Where are they going to get their services if we don't have any providers left? So we need to figure out what the balance is. And as you know, we're always there. Tax increases, revenue enhancements, beer, wine, alcohol, tobacco. You know, I told the previous governor, I can't smoke enough to balance this budget by myself. So, you know, either you all have to start buying cigarettes to help out a little bit, or, you know, I didn't say you had to smoke them, but you got to buy them. Somebody's got to help me pay for the health plan, because I can't do it on my own.
Air. Don't forget air.
Thank you very much.
Senator Schrader and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball. I'm with the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill of Oregon. And first, I'd like to state that the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill appreciates the restoration of some of the mental health and addiction services in House Bill 5030. But we remain gravely concerned. And the concerns are the result of the phone calls and the emails and the lives that we see daily in our offices and over the phone. And there are concerns which are shared by the Latino team, whom I spoke with at Mid Valley Behavioral Healthcare Network this morning. That is a group of Latino workers who work in addiction services and in mental health. And they shared the concerns about what's missing from 5030. And you have a sheet in front of you, gold one, that outlines some of the things that are actually missing. First of all, full funding of the Oregon Health Plan, as well as medically needy coverage for mental health prescriptions, coverage of housing and supported employment, missing dollars for day treatment for children and adolescents, $8.1 million in missing alcohol and drug treatment, general assistance, and funding to implement evidence-based treatment programs, and, of course, the Oregon Children's Plan, which has not been funded. And the reason these are concerns is because these affect real people. They affect real lives. And some of those that the Latino team mentioned to me, and whom I'm familiar with, are, for example, Lydia, who has a brother in Central Oregon with schizophrenia. He worked, so when he was struck with schizophrenia, he received disability payments of about $650 a month. That, of course, makes him ineligible for the Oregon Health Plan. Yet his medications cost $1,100 a month. And with the absence of a medically needy program for mental health medications, his life is in the balance. In addition, while his mother and his sister are working overtime to pay for his medications, he is losing his will to live because the supported employment that kept him feeling like a regular person, somebody who can contribute and be productive, has been taken away. and yet supported employment is an evidence-based best practice. There was also the story of Teresa, who received a letter earlier this year saying her son's day treatment program had been cut because, of course, she's a working parent and the only slots that are left are Medicaid only. Her son was withdrawn from day treatment, and she has called in tears, wondering whether or not she should sign over custody of her child to the state in order to access treatment. There's the story of Darla in Corvallis, whose neighbor appeared last week psychotic. And Darla tried to access crisis services, but it was Friday. Crisis services are closed. They're closed Saturday, they're closed Sunday, maybe on Monday. On Monday, this woman was put in the hospital overnight and sent home to no home with a bag full of medications. Because she had been on the Oregon health plan and became psychotic, she failed to pay her premium. And because of that, with no family, no supports, she is left with nothing. And her desperate neighbors, who are trying out a Christian charity to help her, find that there's nothing with which to help her. And finally, there's the story of Maria, who was actually in a Spanish language class, a family psychoeducation class for mental health. She has a very young son who is exhibiting signs of severe mental health disorder. However, because of her culture, she is having difficulty accessing treatment. And her hope had been that school-based mental health services would provide some support to her when she is struggling to deal with a family that culturally does not accept mental illness as readily as some might. And because of this, she is frightened. She's frightened because culturally specific services seem to be disappearing, because school-based services are disappearing, and because there are no crisis services. People are hanging on by their fingernails. And as these Latino members spoke to me, they said that no matter how thin you spread them, there simply aren't enough frijoles to go around anymore. And they're wondering, what will you do for their community? What will you do for ours? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, and I'm here this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Ambulance Association. Our members are private companies and public agencies that provide 911 emergency ambulance service throughout much of the state. The budget hole that I want to bring your attention to today is a relatively small one. We estimate approximately $375,000 for the entire biennium. But it is a very significant one to our members, especially to those who serve in rural areas. And the issue is the coverage of emergency ambulance services to the adult standard population under the Oregon Health Plan. What happened is earlier this session when committees were ranking the services that that population would receive, emergency ambulances are a federally mandated service, along with physicians and hospitals. When those committees broke out physicians and hospitals so that they could be listed and ranked separately, emergency ambulances were not specified. And in talking to members of the committee and to legislative council, my impression is that that was inadvertent. Nevertheless, I did want to bring it to the attention of this committee. The issue for emergency ambulance providers is that they must and do serve everyone, regardless of ability to pay, regardless of insurance status. And uncompensated costs have grown by leaps and bounds, especially for rural providers in recent years. And the only way that they have to cope with that problem when it becomes severe, and I know from recent meetings that some of them are having to consider taking a vehicle and a crew out of service. That means longer response times, and that obviously affects the number of lives of heart attack, stroke, and accident victims that will be saved. So I wanted to bring this whole to your attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Appreciate it. See if we have Ruth Shepherd come forward. Anyone else that has not testified that would like an opportunity to speak? Very good.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ruth Shepherd, and I'm a resident of Southeast Salem, having migrated from Eugene, as where some of you used to know me. I've listened to the testimony, and I support the overall thrust of the message today, which says that we cannot afford to recommend less than is able to sustain these frail and marginal people. And by sustain, I mean that those of us who watch these programs regularly and closely have a growing concern about the quality of care that is being provided. And we haven't had time to talk about that for two or three sessions. When you are unable to give a salary increase or a COLA to a worker who comes to a foster care home for 3 years, and you can flip pancakes or whatever for the same amount of money, we know that the clients there are very much at risk. I would urge you to rise above the stampede for closure, so that if you were pretending to run a corporation, you'd look very closely at this and take some more time. I'm sorry about the implications of that. What you do, if it's too hurried, is most likely to destroy programs that we cannot rebuild. And I won't emphasize again the eloquent testimony that's come before that says we will find those people in a much more costly setting and eligible for other kinds of treatment that we won't be able to tolerate financially. Just for the second or two I have left, I would like to say that my concerns have long been in this building for long-term care of seniors. And whereas I have developed a real interest in what healthy seniors can do for other seniors and what healthy seniors can do for kids, I'm still very focused on the long-range planning that was the system that made Oregon famous. And I mean was, because I think that we have lost our standing. The important thing for those of you who might just be now visiting the concept of a continuum of care is to understand that when we started out getting additional home care through Project Independence, that we knew that home care was preferred by most seniors, and we knew that much of what seniors need can be delivered in home. And so developing that, then came a development, a further acceleration of foster care, residential care, assisted living, and nursing facilities. And for ever so long, there was an understanding that the appropriate care was the guiding principle by which you would make a placement, and it would be most inappropriate to put have a loved one in a facility that was providing more services than was needed. That's very deleterious. So if you look at the balance and history in the last 6 years or three sessions, my belief is that the balance is out of whack. And what we have, because we have been cutting home care like Project Independence, and not bolstering the Medicaid home care, that we are inappropriately placing people in other kinds of facilities that are inappropriate and too expensive. And I think a careful examination of that in a business-like way, to ask if you're meeting the needs and if the needs are of a quality that you can tolerate, you won't tolerate if you go into some of these facilities. It would be my plea, if we cannot bring the care providers to a reasonable level of funding, we have done a disservice to the patients. And I think we need especially to look at the balance between home care, which is the most desired and has the greatest future for response by the state. We need to look at home care as one of the key elements for budget planning in the future. And we really let it get out of whack if we go ahead with underfunding, for instance, Project Independence. I'd be happy to answer any questions. It was a spontaneous, unprepared presentation.
Very good. Very, very good. Thank you very much, Ms. Shepherd. Well, I appreciate all the testimony. It's been very, very good for us to hear that today. Sometimes we don't get in touch with as many people as we should prior to some of our deliberations. Although we've worked hard, I think, this whole session, I know the subcommittee has done a lot of great work, but for some of us that haven't had the opportunity, it's very good to hear from the real people and the advocates that serve the people, and I appreciate that. With that, the committee will adjourn the public hearing. Thank you.
3 o'clock or 3:30? 3:00.